I still control the Cheka both in Russia and abroad, and I can tolerate so much interference in the way I run it and no more. The trust is a successful instrument of our policy. Every potential threat to your regime has been spotted through its offices. And all that concerns you is that something so successful might one day be turned against you.
It poses a threat to me, not because it's successful, but because it's past its time. In the days when we were fighting a war on a dozen fronts, your phantom had a function. That situation no longer exists.
Because we have successfully contained it. Because we have hundreds of agents abroad who report every move. Agents who operate within the highest echelons of the emigre organizations. Men who control their armies, their security, their funds. Our whole foreign service is self-generating as a result of the money that flows into our accounts from these sources. $3 million last year. We can't afford to lose that kind of operation. We've now reached a situation where we orchestrate the entire opposition. The West believe they lead it, but the fact is we do.
You do. You have so much power, Felix. You don't have to do anything to undermine my position. You merely have to exist.
You question my loyalty.
I want you to demonstrate it by arresting Riley.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 6th of January 2023, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre, that's the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream. And a very happy new year, 2023, to all our loyal listeners, lovely to have you with us, and still to be going, amazingly. So also we're on RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please, not Google. In fact, boycott Google is one of the themes tonight. I'm Tony Gosling, so thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner once more, which is gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops. Smearing the cheap COVID treatments as they did, an estimated 60,000 Brits died. Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity, followed now by God knows how many more from the poison death jabs, and more about that tonight too. Anyway, also of course the new psyop that's taken over from that is the Ukraine psyop. And this week I've done a sort of 2023 book review. It's not a book review, it's a look at the most important books as I see it that everyone should read. And if you were to have a sort of real university, that all those books would be in there, such as Op JB, such as Paul Manning's Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. So, you know, this is to say a university course, a course in history, a course in geopolitics, where actually the real version of history was looked at rather than the official version, as discussed by Norman Dodd from the United States back in the 1970s, when he explained that actually what's happening is the privatisation of our universities. And I think everyone who actually works in a university will agree. We've seen the privatisation of ideas, effectively. Any ideas that the owners don't like, they just kill them. And occasionally we get somebody like the chap that we had on from Lincoln University in, I think it was October, talking some sense. But actually people like him just then tend to get bullied out. So navigating us through the Fourth Reich matrix, we'll be talking about Barth and Barth's involvement in that a bit later, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and in part one, the real leader of the Labour Party. Who is that? Anyway, here's an interesting interview with him on the BBC just after Keir Starmer's speech yesterday. We do a little in memory of Mark Purdy, because he was an incredibly brilliant organic farmer, a genius that I met first, I think it was around about the late 1990s, at the Green Party, when we were doing something called Eye Contact Video Network here in Bristol. We just went out and interviewed him at his farm, High Barn Farm, down in Devon, I think it was. And Mark, it's one of those videos that disappeared when YouTube killed off my public inquiry channel. One of the first videos I did, actually, after leaving the Landis House and the BBC and getting back into journalism. And it's nice to sort of revive these things from time to time and see just how incredibly prescient he was back in 2000. He died, I think it was 6 years or so after I interviewed him, very early age. And he was Purdy, you may know the name, it's the shotgun manufacturing family. And he was an organic farmer who was from that family. But he had all sorts of interesting things to say about the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food and their policies, basically implementing what the big chemical companies, particularly ICI, wanted, using these hideous pesticides, which are basically killing people, not just the animals, driving them mad, mad cow disease and that sort of thing. Also, we announced before Christmas, just before Christmas, Bilderberg in 2023 over in Lisbon. Well, the dates as well now, 17th of May to the 20th of May. And in order to sort of remind ourselves about what Bilderberg's all about and the relationship between that and the Ukraine war, we have a clip of an interview I did at just after a Bilderberg conference in 2016 with, I'd only just met him at that point, Manfred Petrich from allsmokeandmirrors.com. He also, he died last year. So another interesting interview, I think, with somebody that's not around to articulate their views anymore. Anyway, part two, the King's Christmas speech contrasted with Putin's New Year speech. These are, I think, some of the two most powerful people in the West, particularly with Charles's involvement with the World Economic Forum, and the East with Vladimir Putin, who's in charge of the Russian army, just ordered a ceasefire over the Orthodox Christmas period. Also, Putin is apparently to be tried for war crimes. We're going to try and bring in John Bosnich from Belgrade to talk about that. The International Criminal Court in The Hague want to try him, apparently. They're looking for all the evidence. They want maybe even to do so in absentia. Sir Geoffrey Nice, what a great name. Sir Geoffrey Nice is the man that's in charge of trying to do that for the British establishment. And also, we're going to hear from FBI officer Jack Shelton. I had that slated for the show before Christmas, but it was so busy, couldn't use it. So we'll do that tonight. Jack Shelton is the FBI officer who furnished us with the information about who actually shot JFK. You know, the thing is, he was just one man at the FBI, and no one was listening. I don't know if any of the journalists listen, how many he spoke to. But anyway, we'll be hearing from him later on too. So, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, the people that own the satellites, etc., and then belatedly by an organisation called Ofcom, who just do what they're told when they're kicked. Cancelled off, I don't know if you're allowed to say that, or maybe that's against the Ofcom rules. If you'd like to complain to Ofcom that I just said that, please do feel free to write to them saying that this show should be taken off the air for saying that Ofcom do whatever they're told by their political masters. Cancelled off Bristol Community FM by Pat Hart and his Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here. So, Martin, the way to start, I think, has got to be the kind of attempt by Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer this week to, I mean, they both did very lacklustre speeches, which I'm not going to trouble you or listeners with now, at the Christmas New Year speeches. Very, very boring. But what they've tried to do is put that all behind them and come up with some genuine political speeches this week.
Well, originally Starmer was scheduled to make, you know, a major speech this week. And I think that the number 10 Downing Street decided that they were going to have Rishi Sunak wheeled out to make a speech to try and, you know, basically mess up Keir Starmer's big occasion.
Well, queer his pitch, maybe, or else pip him at the post.
Yeah.
Because actually, the Sunak one was the day before, wasn't it?
That's right. And that was organised at the last minute when they knew that Starmer was going to be speaking and so on. And it's virtually in the same part of the world, you know, it's the same part of town. You know, in other words, they're trying to make sure that, because part of the game of politics and the mainstream is making sure your name is on the news.
Well, I mean, it doesn't look as if
Starmer's
Sunak
name's on the news, Rishi Sunak's got to make sure his name's been on the news as well.
Irritates me, I don't know for you, but irritates me more than anything else when we hear these speeches, is the lack of criticism by the press of them, and the idea that these are great political leaders and they're going to do these things even. When Sunak was making his speech, it did look to me as if there were all the various problems that he's got to deal with. Everyone knows that the Daily Mail and the Express and the Mirror keep pointing out, even the Morning Star, actually, day after day, this needs to be dealt with. He would cover those in his speech and he would say, I'm going to deal with them all, but he didn't come out with any actual concrete commitments at all.
Well, obviously, what happened at his press conference after his speech was that even the Tory press were asking him, what are you going to do about the strike wave, for example? And the only thing he's got is, we're going to bring in legislation to ban strikes and unions.
Idea is that they're not going to deal with the strike wave, isn't it?
Well, in other words, the five things that he said he was going to do, none of them are anything to do with that. But he came up with he had to come up with five things to do. And obviously the most eye-catching one was compulsory maths for everybody to the age of 18. Which, of course, if they just pulled that rabbit out of a hat, what can I come up with which was completely new and challenging and innovative?
It's making policy on the hoof. It certainly came across as a back-of-the-fag packet job.
Absolutely.
And I wasn't getting much of that from the press. There were some critical voices around, but a lot of people just taking this as if these are our political leaders, they're democratically elected. Great wise words.
Yeah, well, don't forget the Tory press is there to go rah-rah Rishi Sunak, apart from those who were going, what about Boris Johnson? And, of course, the Keir Starmer only gets treated as serious by the non-commercial press, really.
That's not true. I listened to PM programme yesterday. Yeah. They had a guy from the Telegraph. A minute. They had a guy from the Telegraph actually saying that he thought Sunak's speech was rubbish. You know, paraphrasing him. And that Starmer stood out. And actually, of course, Starmer is something like 20% ahead in the polls right now.
Yeah, well, obviously what's happening now at the tops of various boardrooms of companies is they're now thinking, right, well, Starmer's going to be the new chief, so we need to keep him. And, of course, from Starmer's point of view, this is what he wants. He wants to be seen as a prime minister in waiting. And therefore, you know, people are beating a path to his door to see what he thinks and to lobby him for what they want, of course.
There's something very strange about all of this, what with the Conservative leadership changes that took place in the summer. And if you were in charge of the Conservative Party, really, if you had any honour, you'd probably go out on the balcony and shoot yourself. Because actually, Boris was ahead in the polls. They decided to jettison Boris. Yes, he was.
No, he wasn't.
He was ahead of Starmer in the polls.
He was ahead of Starmer for being PM, but the Tory party itself had been wiped out at a series of by-elections, completely wiped out in their heartland.
So why have they got rid of Boris to put in Sunak, to actually then
put in Liz Truss?
That people, won't be voting for Sunak.
No, it's only the MPs who voted for Sunak.
No, the Tory party supporters. I remember, if you remember, we did an interesting poll on here around about, was it August, September? So it must be September time, saying, the Tory voters said that they wouldn't vote for Sunak and they wouldn't vote for Truss. They'd only vote for Boris. So what the Conservative Party have done, literally, and I mean it, these people should go and shoot themselves, throw themselves off the balcony, because what they've done is they've just completely jettisoned. I mean, obviously, it's a great thing for you. You'll be rubbing your hands that the Tory party are not going to win the next general election because of what's happened over the summer.
Well, what's happened over the summer was the culmination of what's happened since the crash in 2008 and since 1979,
It's about personalities, not about policy. It's about Boris being liked by potential Tory voters, even, you know, people who might traditionally vote Labour, and Sunak just being seen as a rich kid who's a wannabe and he's got no interest in ordinary people, no knowledge of them. Did you see, I don't know if you saw the thing before Christmas where he went to visit the homelessness people, and he was saying, do you work in financial services?
Well, actually, if you actually read the full account of that, it wasn't as bad as it was spun by the Labour opposition, because the guy had actually already asked him about financial services when he started talking about it. But in any case, the Tory party's got a fundamental problem, is that their product is rubbish. no matter what you're trying to, how you're trying to sell it, the product is rubbish. And but Boris Johnson,
so the Labour Party product is,
no, the Labour Party product is that we are not going to be as rubbish as the Tory Party product, which is a fairly low bar.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, people, you know, and mainstream politics in this country, this Punch and Judy knockabout because of the two-party system, the first past the post and all the rest of it, nobody else gets a look in, and the debate is conducted like a Thai boxing contest.
So these great speeches, we're going to have a listen now, and thank you to the producers up at Network Radio, Radio 4, who put this montage together for the PM programme yesterday, which I thought was wonderful. So this is a montage of the two speeches. You have to see if you can work out which one is being said by which and which party, if there's any difference between the two.
The control people want is control over their lives and their communities. So we will embrace the take back control message, but we'll turn it from a slogan into a solution, from a catchphrase into change. We will spread control out of Westminster, devolve new powers over employment support, transport, energy, climate change, housing, culture, childcare provision, and how councils run their finances. And we'll give communities a new right to request powers which go beyond even that. All this will be in a new Take Back Control Bill, a centrepiece of our first King's Speech. That bill will deliver on the demands for a new Britain, a new approach to politics and democracy, a new approach to growth and our economy. We must look forward with hope. But for hope to flourish, Britain needs change.
A future that restores optimism, hope and pride in Britain.
They always know the Labour Party cares. And they can now see a party that is both competent and compassionate.
Since I became Prime Minister, we've made progress.
A party that understands what it means to put service to the country first.
People don't want politicians who promise the earth and then fail to deliver.
A fairer, greener, more dynamic country with an economy that works for everyone.
We will halve inflation this year to ease the cost of living and give people financial security.
We will spread control out of Westminster, devolve new powers over employment support, transport, energy.
We will grow the economy, creating better paid jobs and opportunity right across the country.
All this will be in a new Take Back Control Bill, a centrepiece of our first King's Speech.
No tricks, no ambiguity. We're either delivering for you or we're not.
So, yes, I think quite a lot of empty rhetoric. The only thing that really does stand out there is this whole idea of a Take Back Control Bill.
Well, it's, you know...
From the Labour Party.
Well, I mean, if they're talking about what they probably mean, strengthening devolution in Wales and Scotland, but it also means giving more powers to local authorities. But where's the meat of that? The thing they could say is we're going to abolish council tax and bring back the rates,
for example. No meat to it at all. It's saying devolving power.
So in other words, we're going to give councils real financial independence, which they used to have before the Thatcher era.
Devolving power to councils, but no extra money.
Well, that's right.
So what does that mean? Nothing.
Well, I mean, but the point is, you know, they're both appealing to the same few hundred thousand, possibly less than a million, middle ground swing voters. And that's why they sound the same, because it's exactly the kind of people they're trying to get through.
Didn't this work for Tony Blair, though?
Well, it does. It does work if you can make it work. But it's the reason why you get this rhetoric that sounds so similar is because of the way our political system works. You have to crowd onto that ground to talk the kind of drivel that those kind of people want to hear.
Jeremy Corbyn didn't do that. But no, he nearly won, actually, didn't he? Well, he was undermined by his own party from inside.
Yes, but I mean,
and he probably would have won if he hadn't been.
Well, indeed. But then his own party, not necessarily on his side, because they're only in the same party because of the political system.
I'm talking about his apparatchiks, not just ordinary party members.
I'm just trying to say that in other countries, the political debate is conducted in a rather different way because you're rallying your own troops in the first place. You don't have to worry about swing voters in marginal constituencies in the suburban towns around London, which is what it's all about. In
the last
Britain.
General election, the Tories robbed a fantastic number of voters from the north and actually swung the vote in many of these.
That's right. So that's exactly.
Is Starmer going to be able to get those back, do you think?
Well, it looks as if he is, if you look at the opinion polls. Yeah.
Well, quite possibly.
So therefore he's, you know, and for example, there are people in the Labour Party who want him to take a stronger line on condemning Brexit, and he's already said, we're not going to do that, we're not going to go back that at all.
I suppose the point of all of this is that this is a new, maybe, you know, I see it as a new low in rubbish politics, rubbish speeches, nonsense speeches, things like Sunak saying he's going to reintroduce some new bill to stop the crossing of the Channel. Well, that was supposed to have happened 2 or 3 years ago, that they were going to do that. They did introduce a new bill. It didn't do anything.
I mean, that's so, because laws, it's like King Canute saying you're going to stop the waves coming on the beach. And of course you can't. The people are going to cross the Channel. You can pass a law against it, but it ain't going to stop them doing it, is it?
No, you're absolutely right. So it's empty rhetoric. But this, I think, Martin, is there's a devious purpose behind all this empty rhetoric, and that is that there is a deliberate attempt to undermine and discredit the whole democratic system. We've never seen, I don't think in my lifetime anyway, such appalling leading politicians as we've got today. And in a way, Sunak seems to me to have been brought in just to make sure that Starmer looks credible, whereas before he was not credible and he wasn't liked, no one was going to vote for him. Now that we've got someone as bad as Sunak running the Tory party, Starmer stands a chance.
Well, I think they got rid of Boris Johnson because he's like Marmite. People either loved him or hated him. Same with Nigel Farage, who's never managed on the first post to get elected in this country.
I'm talking about Farage. A lot of Labour voters liked Boris. That was the problem.
Until he got
caught. And it was a bit of a Trump card, really, wasn't it?
No, yeah, but also his personality became the policy. And, of course, his personality was very flawed.
But aren't elections often won on personality?
No, they ought to be won on policy, Tony, as you
well
know.
They ought to be, but that's not the way. When the politics is broken, the personality starts to reign supreme.
And, of course, what's happened with the presidentialisation of our politics, so that we're even first past the post in the US, has led to presidentialism in politics. And of course, Britain and the US are the only countries, developed countries, that have got that system. And it does lead to a trivialisation of everything. That's what the problem is. And that's why the Irish broke out of the United Kingdom in the 1920s, and plenty of people in North Wales and in Scotland don't want to play that game anymore.
And then got sucked into Brussels. A lot of Irish people regret that.
I think you'll find in the opinion polls in Ireland that's not the case, Tony.
They'd much rather be with Northern Ireland than they would with Belgium, wouldn't they?
No. In actual fact, the Southern Irish did rather well out of being in the EU until the banking system collapsed. It used to be a rather poor country where everybody had to leave to get a job, either in Britain or somewhere else. Now, of course, as a result of being in the EU and all the subsidies that they got from richer countries like Germany, Ireland, in fact, Southern Ireland has now got a better standard of living than in the north of Ireland, which never used to be the case.
You brought in the idea of you know, whether or not the US, you know, is similar to the UK. We've seen this mad thing going on this week with Kevin McCarthy. Apparently, the American House of Representatives cannot decide on who they want to be their speaker to replace Pelosi.
Well, that's because the Republicans have got a hard core of 20 far right, the most right wing of their party, who will not accept this guy because he's not right wing enough
Trumpites,
for them.
The Trumpites.
Well, they're not even the Trumpites.
They
Trump,
are, yeah,
in fact,
are.
No, that some of them are Trumpites,
they
some
are
of
Trumpites.
Them aren't. Yeah. In actual fact, Trump, I understand, said he wanted McCarthy. And in actual fact, McCarthy got less votes after that in the Republican Party than he got before. But the thing is,
well, maybe
with the first past the post system, they've only got a majority of one in the Congress. Mm. Therefore, when you've only got a majority of one, just one person saying, I don't agree with this, the whole thing grinds to a halt. This is the problem with the checks and balances in the famous American system.
It's not just America. Many countries have had long, long drawn out, in Ireland particularly, they had the similar thing, long drawn out negotiations to actually even bother to get together to form a government.
Yes, but that's because, in actual fact, you've got to pull everybody in before you can form the government. What happens on the first pass of the post is you win the election, and then the fight takes place within one party. Whereas in other places, in Ireland, for example, the parties have to negotiate a coalition, and that does take time.
Well,
obviously.
Sometimes it's never going to happen.
Well, in Belgium and Italy, frequently, the government of the country has been carrying on for quite long periods, over a year or more, without any government.
So that's not first past the post causing it, then?
No, it isn't, but in Belgium, what causes the problem, you've got the split between the Flemish-speaking and the Walloon-speaking areas, so maybe they shouldn't be one country. The Walloons would like to have their own
so
country.
So the Americans are on an 11th vote now, maybe we've just heard from an hour or so ago, so that was a failure too. So, do you think at the end, at the back of all of this, a lot of voters, a lot of individuals, a lot of people thinking about where to spend their money, for example, maybe even private equity, are looking at this political system and seeing it as just not, is rubbish. It's broken. The words that the politicians are speaking, apart from when Liz Truss does her best to destroy the economy with Kwasi Kwarteng, are empty. So all they can do is just keep talking about things that they might do, but they probably will never do. Or the alternative is to say the wrong thing and destroy the economy. So it really, you're left between the lesser of various evils, aren't you? There's nobody to really positively vote for.
Well, that's a point of view and a fairly common one that you will find. Yeah.
This benefits the fascists, is what I'm saying. It benefits the big corporations who are sitting there saying, well, actually, we want to run things.
Well,
please.
Of course, in actual fact, politics has been denuded of its power. So in actual fact, we're regarding about who's going to be in charge, even though they've got no power to do anything, because in actual fact, the Pentagon and Wall Street decide the policy coordinated by the intelligence services. And all of this election stuff is simply to keep the masses happy.
I suppose this is why there was such a big effort on the anti-Semitism scandal and the anti-Corbyn scandal within the Labour Party. Because if Jeremy Corbyn had been allowed to get in, that would actually have lit a fire under this nonsense, and suddenly you'd have had somebody who was like a rock star. When they go around the country, you get tens of thousands of people going to see them in a stadium. Yes. You might get that with Donald Trump in the States, but who is it in British politics today who you would get a stadium full of people cheering?
You don't necessarily want a stadium full of cheering.
Well, no, what I'm saying is that the actual popular support is reflected in amongst the public.
Yes, but at the same time, lots of people were very pro-Corbyn, and I would have been one of them. But other people were so turned off by the propaganda against him that, for example, the Lib Dems could have
put Corbyn into power. He was able to attract a crowd.
Yes, he was.
Where, for example, who was the guy that stood against him? Oh, gosh, can't remember.
Owen Jones.
Was it? Yeah. I mean, I remember seeing one of his rallies, and there was about seven or eight people there.
Yes, I know. But
Corbyn has got 10,000.
Yes, I know, but it isn't just... politics isn't being a rock star. Jeremy Corbyn's failure, in my view, is because he didn't commit to changing the electoral system and reforming the political system.
What it was like in those days was like almost like the old-fashioned hustings, where people would actually bother to turn out, because they weren't seeing a lot of this on the media. A lot of the press was giving nonsense stuff about Corbyn, but they knew, oh, Corbyn's coming to our town, we can actually go and see him speak, and there's no press in the way. And so it was like going back to the sort of Victorian or pre-TV days, where the MPs and the candidates would come out and do hustings in the street.
Yes, and Lloyd George used to speak for 4 hours, and people used to queue for 3 days to hear it, but there was no television.
That's too long.
And they had to make their own entertainment in those days.
So, anyway, who is running the Labour Party, Martin, these days now? Who's really running it?
Well, the Labour Party is, as always, a big amalgam of different forces. It's still largely funded by trade union money, so they still have quite a big say in what happens. But, of course, you've also got, it's very important for big capital to be able to control both political parties, just like the Democrats in the US. The Democrats are supposedly the more left-wing party, but loads of hedge funds and all these billionaires give them money so that if they come to power, they can tell them what to do. A lot of politics, Tony, is actually money. And if people who have more money generally tend to win elections because they can buy the advertising and so on.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn was almost... So, I mean, if you've got decent, balanced sort of mixed economy policies and good human rights stuff, like pro-Palestinian rather than pro-Israeli or questioning NATO, for example, if somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, you've got to be in one of the main parties in order to stand a chance. It seems to me what Jeremy did was he realised that he was never ever going to get his message out through the mass media. So, you know, he might get a few little sound bites here and there. So he had to go out on the streets. So he managed to find a way around it. But then the deep state, the elite, whoever you want to call them, the establishment, managed to find a way around him by infiltrating his party and destroying him from within.
They didn't need to infiltrate. The actual full-time workers for the Labour Party were always hostile to him. Yeah? So in other words, he's got... And he could have sacked them all.
Couldn't he have dealt with them?
No, because...
I mean, Starmer has had a massive purge,
hasn't
he?
Yes, I know, because the right can do these things. Just as if Jeremy Corbyn had come to power with a totally costed manifesto, when Liz Truss crashed and burned earlier in the year, John McDonald wrote an article in The Guardian where he said, well, we went round the City of London and talked to all the big money people and told them what we were going to do and told them how we were going to pay for it. They didn't like it, but they said, OK, we'll have to accept it if you win because you've costed it all out. Because the Labour Party has got to cost it all out, because in any case, they really are going to be looking for every attempt to overturn you, whereas the Tory party just say, well, we haven't costed it, but it doesn't matter.
At that point, do you think the city said, look, we're not having this? Is that what the city said at the time?
About McDonald or Liz Truss?
We're behind McDonald's back.
No, I think what McDonald knew very well was that you've got to talk to these people to keep them sweet as so far as you can.
Well, they certainly managed to do that to get Blair in, didn't they? Because the city came in behind them.
Blair's deal with the city is, I'm not going to do anything. You know, what's it Mandelson said? We're seriously relaxed about people getting filthy rich.
Funny you should mention him, because if there was such a thing as propaganda uno in Britain with some kind of ageing fascist in charge, a sort of secret government behind the scenes, here's one person you could almost guarantee would be sitting on that committee.
What I feel about the speech is that it signals quite a major changing of gear by Keir Starmer, and I think you're going to see more of this during the course of the year, a much greater focus on policy direction and priorities, and I think that's very important. But if I had to sort of take out one theme, and by the way, you know, I love them stealing back, taking back control, by the way. I think that that is very cute, very clever communication. I think it's rather brilliant, because essentially what it's saying is that Brexit did not enable us to take back control. It hasn't brought the benefits and the advantages to Britain that were promised. The Tories have failed on what they promised, and therefore Labour can do things differently and better. That's essentially what this communications device says. But if I had to take one really central thing out of the speech this morning, it would be that we've got to switch our focus from the short term to the long term, the sort of short term crisis management and inexorable decline that we've seen in Britain over the last 10 years, to a more deep seated long term renewal of the country, which is probably going to take at least a decade. And for that, Keir Starmer has got to win not one term, but two. And I think he's setting sail in very much in that direction.
Yeah. Do you feel that there's as much preparation for government going on as opposed to finding good lines in speeches? As much preparation for government going on
Much more than before, in my view. I think there's a strong concentration on the economy and how a major green prosperity deal can be harnessed to lift economic growth. I think they're already beginning to think through important advances in the National Health Service and other public services, their reform and delivery. I think it's important that this very centralized system of government that we have in England should bring more power and funding to all parts of the country. And I think that securing our national defenses, given what's going on in the rest of the world, is also very important. And I think it's in those areas, those blocks, those missions, if you like, that you're going to see more work undertaken and revealed during the course of this year.
Yeah.
Well, he's saying there pretty much...
This is Peter Mandelson, let's be clear. Now, Mandelson he was in charge of the campaign in 1997 that won Tony Blair the general election, wasn't it?
That's why he's being asked.
And kicked out John Major's government. Or was it, no, was it maybe someone Major. After Major? Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's saying what I would have expected him to say. And if you read between the lines, you will see that no doubt the top financial people, the civil service, the military, they see a Labour government on the horizon. And that's why he's going about the defences of our country and all of this stuff. So they're showing to the establishment that we are a safe pair of hands. You don't have to worry about us. That Corbyn guy, the beardy one, he's gone now. He's not even in the Labour Party.
We don't talk about him anymore. No mention of his name. Don't worry.
That's right. So you can see what's happening. I confidently think that Starmer will be the next PM, but what may happen is he won't have an overall majority and he'll have to talk to other political forces. And we'll have to see whether that comes true or not.
So he's saying things. So it's great. One of the great, brilliant to have right at the beginning of the year, such a fantastic Freudian slip there, where he says, stealing back control. rather than taking back control, he accidentally said stealing back control. I'm not sure if you saw
yes,
that.
Yes, well, so I mean, all this stuff
is
about
stealing in Mandelson's nature. I think, yes, it is.
Well, he and Nathan Rothschild, who's a major Tory donor, were both on Oleg Deripaska's yacht. Do you remember? Years ago, when we were friendly with Russian oligarchs, instead of demanding their heads on pikes.
Well, yes, it all depends which way those oligarchs lean, doesn't it?
Well, most
some of them tried to sort of be friends with Putin and the West, but they realised after a while you're not allowed to do that.
No. Well, in those days, it wasn't so clear-cut. And Tory Party and Labour Party people could be on the same yacht together with these oligarchs. And that just shows you how the real politics behind the scene works when everybody, you know, when everybody's gone, the children have gone to bed.
Does anyone still in the Labour Party call Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, the Prince of Darkness?
I don't know, Tony. I mean, the reason why he's come in for such a lot of criticism from all sides is because he actually went to my college at St. Catherine's, and he was there just before I was there, and he had a reputation for being a complete social climber. But of course, he comes from a very strongly Labour, right-wing Labour family. You know, Herbert Morrison was his grandfather. So these people see the Labour Party as almost like a personal property. And they, you know, keeping the left at bay and being the government is very much where they think they're coming from. And they see themselves as terribly, terribly serious as well. This is why they get that serious tone about Ukraine and so on. But of course, in the Ukraine and all these other, like invading Iraq and all these other things that they did, that's exactly why they are part of the establishment. And that's why they intend to be the government and be an establishment government. Nobody should be surprised by that. That's the way the world works.
Nat Rothschild, you mentioned there, very friendly with Mandelson, is the youngest among four siblings, the only son of Jacob Rothschild and Serena. He was born in 1971, 12th of July, to a Jewish father and Christian mother. His father is a banker. So Jacob Rothschild has died now, I think, hasn't he? But Mandelson still lives on. He went to Collett Court, where he studied with George Osborne. Collett Court, where is that? I don't know where. Anyway, I think that's, I thought that was in around Shepherd's Bush somewhere, where they shot the Sweeney. I'm not sure. Or Euston Films were
based. I thought they were both ex-Eton, weren't they?
Yes, but then he went to, just a minute, he then later went to Eton College and Wadham College to study history. And is fond of luxuries that were not in line with his educational interests. So then he became an investment banker. This is Nat we're talking about now. The company bank has been under the ownership of the Rothschild family, and the management is hereditary. So I suppose if you've got somebody on the left wing that's just cozying up to the city, cozying up particularly to the main family in the City of London, the Rothschild family, then they're bound to be on the right of the party. They're bound to be see the left as a big competition, actually. In fact, in many ways, more than the Tories.
Absolutely. And that's because if we had a different political system, all of these people would be in different political parties and it wouldn't function in that way. The same sort of forces would be at work, but it wouldn't. Britain in particular has got this old boy network related to the, you know, the leadership of the two main parties and the control of the City of London and the military and so on. And you know, that's Bullington. You know, we are one of the, you know, the tradition of all the dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living.
Bullington Club, Nat Rothschild,
all of that stuff.
Apparently, most of his investments, rumoured to be around £40 billion, are in trusts in Switzerland, where he lives most of the time. Now he will nip back to the UK occasionally to do various things. He stays, I think, as you said, something about Corfu is another place he likes to hang out. I just find it fascinating to see that behind the scenes you've got somebody like Lord Mandelson, who was so interesting. I mean, the thing is, many of the people in the Labour Party look to Mandelson as the man who spearheaded the Blair campaign. They want to do something similar again, don't they, with Starmer?
Yes, and you can see why many middle-of-the-road Labour people feel they just don't want the Tories in power, because they're vicious. The Labour Party is not good, isn't going to change society in any radical way, and that quite suits the sort of middle class people who are in this group. But it's going to get rid of the sheer incompetence of people like Liz Truss, who can't string a sentence together and lost $30 billion in the finances of the government in 1 week. You know, they're just not fit to govern. And of course, you know, the professional classes would like a sensible Labour Party that isn't going to rock the boat too much. And that's exactly who they're appealing to. And that's who they are. And it shouldn't be surprising that they are who they are. But of course, they're going to get a big shock if they do come to power, because the crisis of global capitalism isn't going to allow them to just hum and haw and do small things.
As we know, politician Zelensky over in Ukraine is backed by an oligarch, Kolomoisky.
They've drifted apart in recent times.
Have they fallen out? Oh, dear.
Now, what's happened is that Kolomoisky is under investigation both in Ukraine and the United States. He's in Israel. And Zelensky's...
He's a joint Israeli-Ukrainian
citizen. Yes, like many oligarchs in both Ukraine and Russia are.
It provides him with a perfect mafia bolt hole, doesn't it?
Yes, really? It does. But the thing about Zelensky is he's now been taken over lock, stock and barrel by the Western intelligence services. He's their spokesperson.
I mean, I just see Nat Rothschild as the financial backer of people like Mandelson.
Nat Rothschild is a Tory. But at the same time, he'd be more happy to have Mandelson than... Yeah, the thing is, that, as I say, the very wealthy, they hedge their bets.
But this is how propaganda Uno... Martin, let me tell you, this is how propaganda Uno works. They all sit around the same table, fixing up both sides of the chessboard.
Yes, they do. And if you want that to change, you've got to mobilise and organise and all the rest
like
of it.
Corbyn,
we're a long way from
you
that.
You need
yet.
Somebody like Corbyn. We may have to wait another 25, 30 years.
Corbyn was an attempt to try and challenge the situation, but it's always going to be an uphill struggle. The reason why the powerful in society are powerful is because they are powerful. They control all the levers. They control the media. They control the army. They control the City of London. They can, you know, it's very difficult to fight against that. And I'm not saying you shouldn't try, and attempts should be made to change things. But it usually is very difficult because the powers that be are powerful, you know. What's that old rap song goes, fight the power? You've got to fight the powers that be.
Okay, maybe we should see if we can play that 1 week, Martin. It sounds like a good song. Anyway, yes, I know the song. Who was it? Did it? Oh, I'm sure some of our listeners can think straight away. I can't. Anyway, so local government, apparently, is going to be working with big business if Peter Mandelson and Keir Starmer get their way.
Are they doing as much, though, to prepare for government as you lot were in the 1990s, in 95 to 97?
Well, in a real sense, I think they're doing more. I mean, I was very interested to read during the course of today, since Starmer made his speech, a background note on what this take-back control piece of legislation would actually mean. And I tell you, it has more in it, more depth, and it reaches into more areas of policy, frankly, than we had when we had the same intention of raising economic growth across the country. And I'm rather impressed by it. I think it will equip local towns and communities with a more powerful political voice. I think it will give them stronger levers of policy. I think it will enable them to get the services of good, experienced officials and very strong business networks. And those are the essential ingredients that we need if the entirety of the country is going to contribute to economic growth rather than just one part of it.
Okay, well, it's very interesting you say that about that specific thing, because some people said it was a bit of a phrase and we didn't really know what it was actually going to mean
I think what lies behind it is actually quite considerable. I think it's about spreading out the economic growth process to across the country. I mean, obviously, we need London and the South East to keep going well. We need our great universities, Oxford, Cambridge, London, Manchester, Newcastle, Edinburgh, and the rest to keep performing. But we need other parts of the country to be given the means to catch up with the rest. And I think this is really very central to Labour's programme.
That's important to know. You express concern in a newspaper column that people might be trying to turn Keir Starmer or Labour into a sort of British Greta Thunberg, and they shouldn't get distracted by things that are not core. Now, talk me through what you think is going wrong.
No, 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 no. No. Let me make this clear to you, Evan. What I don't like is the sort of image building gimmickry. Oh, we've got to turn Keir Starmer into something else. That we've got to sort of create a confection around him. No, I think he's much better as he was this morning when he's talking seriously about policy, when he's setting out a vision and a program which will be subsequently supported by detailed policy. He's a serious guy who's run a very, very important public service, the Crown Prosecution Service in this country. He's professional. His professionalism is underpinned by very strong values and beliefs. He's not one simply for sound bites and photo opportunities and gimmicks. And that is really what the point I was making in my article.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's saying he's presenting an image of Keir Starmer as sensible, competent, the sort of guy who can get the job done. And that is an image, isn't it? If you like, you know, saying we don't want it. We want him to be seen to be serious and all the rest of it.
In my deluded way, this is how I see him.
Yeah. I think when he talks about economic growth, I think that's going to be the problem for the Tories going into the election and for Labour coming out of the election, because it's quite possible we're going to go into the biggest depression since the 1930s, and therefore tinkering at the edges won't do. Now, the Corbyn government had a radical manifesto. It was far too long, you know. There was lots of stuff in it. You know, free broadband and all the rest of it. Oh, free broadband. What's the matter with free broadband? Yeah, you could provide it to everybody, so even the poorest person's got free broadband.
It's a form of nationalisation. Yeah. It's quite a good idea.
Yes, and of course,
for telecoms, actually, in the old days, as you and I can remember, it was the post office, telecoms was all nationalised.
Now, what we might see happen is because the Tories are determined that they're not going to give in to the unions over the recent demands that the unions have been making, is that I'm afraid there's going to be an ongoing general strike all the way up to the election. The unions aren't going to settle, and nor are the government. Now, when Starmer wins the election, which I think he probably will, the question is whether he'll have an outright majority or not, and that's a big question, because, of course, Scotland used to vote solidly for Labour, and it's not clear that they will. He can't presume that they will. And that may lead to a situation where he won't have an overall majority.
But they have to do a deal with the Scottish Nationalists.
They have to deal with the SNP. But he's already said, I'm not doing any deals with the SNP, because he's trying to keep English voters on side. But of course, in Scotland, he's not going anywhere with that in Scotland.
What do you make of what he's saying there about that we want business or big business to be doing partnership agreements and basically helping to steer local government?
Well, my view on that is this. When you talk about devolving power to local government, the question is, what resources will local government have? Now, the British centralised state worked best after World War II, when nursery schools in Scotland were paid for by taxing property prices in southeast England, and therefore you've got a big redistributive mechanism. And what it does, if you do it properly, is that it keeps inflation down in the southeast core, geographical core of the British economy, whilst boosting incomes in the periphery, you know, the Celtic fringe and all the rest of it, and the northern towns, and you've got an overall regional policy and industrial policy. Thatcher smashed all of that. I can't see that Keir Starmer is going to rebuild it. What will happen is, in order to come to power, the Labour Party will do deals with the City of London, the Americans, the wealthy classes, and they will be very limited in what they can do.
But we're bringing you into local government. You know, they're like that, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, we can see what's happened here in Bristol.
Yes, we can.
Where you've got a Labour mayor. But of course, they've got no money. They've massively cut the budget from central.
They do have money. It's just that they've been wasting it on things like Bristol Energy. Martin, this is quite a lot of money, isn't it? 50 million to just pour down the drain.
It is a lot of money, but in terms of the overall spend of the council, it's not that much. Far more money is spent most of the money for the local council doesn't come from local taxes anyway. It comes from central government. And what has happened is the central government has basically left the Labour authorities with their photogenic mayors with no money. So they then have to go to business and say, why don't we do joint partnerships? This is the point, isn't it?
Well, then of course the business says, well, only if we control the policy.
Yes, that's right. And of course, the Labour Party are flagging up to the business community.
That's what's
happened. We are not a threat to you, so don't worry about us.
For anyone that doesn't know, we've got this thing called the One City Plan, which is really sidelining all of the elected councillors and the mayor just self-selecting various individuals who are friends of his, usually business people, in order to run these kind of what used to be committees on various aspects of city life, like housing and things like that. Now it's a little committee that runs it, people who are just selected by the mayor. No one's voted for any of them. In fact, the councillors are being completely shut out of that process.
Well, the whole point of having an elected mayor is exactly that,
isn't it? It's privatisation by a Labour mayor.
Yes, I mean, yes. So the whole thing of bringing in elected mayors, which the Tories did some years ago, as you know, was that they knew that they were going to cut the money to the cities where those mayors would be elected, and then they would have to do what they wanted because they wouldn't have any money.
Well, he's saying that he was also talking there about how wonderfully Keir Starmer did at the Crown Prosecution Service. Now, my recollection is that no, it was a disaster as a Crown Prosecutor. Two major things he got wrong. One was failing to prosecute Jimmy Savile while Jimmy Savile was still alive, even after Surrey Police presented him with two loads of evidence about Savile's abuse of kids. And secondly, was approving the attempt to extradite by the Americans and on the Swedes, Julian Assange. At the time, I think we were talking here about, it must be about 12, 13 years ago. So he's made a mess of being Crown Prosecutor. And in fact, many would see Starmer as the man who was given one of these top jobs simply because he was a tool of the establishment in that very important role when he was supposed to be judicially independent. He wasn't a tool. He was just a tool.
But you'll understand that the real constituency he has to mollify are exactly that establishment. And he did exactly what they wanted. He didn't prosecute Savile, because Savile's linked to MI5, probably. And he didn't, and he agreed to this extradition of Assange, because that's what the Americans told him to do. And that's what the establishment wants. And if you think the ordinary people in this country care about that as much as we do, I have a bridge to sell you.
Well, all right.
Because they're
maybe
more
they
interested
don't.
In
but,
who
I mean,
won the
I
football.
Think, no, listen, I think the reason people tune into shows like this is because they are interested in this
the people
kind of
listening
thing.
To this show, I would agree with you. But the population in general, that's not top of their list of things to care
anyway,
about.
Anyway, Peter Mandelson, Prince of Darkness, the man who sits around the propaganda Uno table, he is, well, I'm just guessing about that, because he's obviously someone who's a big mover and shaker in the establishment, and he's got access, it seems, to large amounts of money. He's also someone I can remember years ago hearing that, this is after I was at the BBC, hearing that when someone said something they didn't like, a journalist would, their editor would get a phone call from Peter Mandelson saying, get rid of that person, or I don't want to hear them on the radio again, this sort of thing. So Mandelson was somebody who was an operator in the system, trying to make sure that critical voices in journalism were shut down, sacked, had their careers destroyed, hatchet jobs written on them, all this sort of thing. So Mandelson is, you know, not my favourite person, which is why I quite like to hear from him as the real leader of the Labour Party.
We've spoken about him before. I would say you're sounding more enthusiastic than you were last time, when I would have thought you were on about a 6.5 out of 10 for Keir Starmer. And you're sounding quite
near. I'm a lot nearer 8.5 than 6.5. I think he's really changed gear this morning. I tell you, something's happened to him. It's probably a combination of being ahead in the opinion polls, and that sort of gives you a fillip. I think he's much more confident. I think he's much more sure about where the direction in which he wants to take the Labour Party in policy terms. I think he has now real authority in the party. There's nobody questioning him or doubting where he's going. I mean, he has strength, he has authority, and now he is turning what is quite a strong intellect to what is really important, and that is the program and the policies supporting that program that's going to turn around the country. And I think the fact that he was just so much more upbeat and so much more relaxed as well and confident than frankly we saw the Prime Minister yesterday, I think that says something about him. I think he's just, you know, he's gained his mojo, and I think he's on his way, but he's not there yet. The general election is not going to take place the day after tomorrow. We've got at least another year and more. But that gives him the time to equip himself and the party with much greater policy depth, and that's what they now need to acquire.
Peter Mountain, good to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, they're saying much greater policy depth. Starmer, when he was elected as leader of the party, promised that he was going to stick to many of the manifesto pledges that Jeremy Corbyn made in 2019. He's now saying, even though I voted for him, I knew he was going to rip that up. And of course he has ripped it up. It's now a question of the Labour Party bigwigs and spin doctors and policy wonks coming up with a programme which is acceptable to the establishment but also appeals to the ordinary folk as being something that they can get behind, and obviously from an obvious point from their point of view, from the right wing of the Labour Party point, is not to talk up that they're going to be able to do anything too much too quickly. So he's already said, when we come to power, we're not going to just get out the chequebook. But he hasn't, and this is significant, he hasn't committed to stick to Tory spending targets, which of course Blair did. Blair had to stick to Tory spending targets to keep the City of London happy. But Starmer significantly didn't do that. And I think that's because he wants the option, and he's going to need the option. If we go into the biggest crisis since the 1930s, he may have to do things that he can't talk about now at the minute.
The establishment aren't going to. So you reckon he's keeping all this up his sleeve? The establishment are never going to back him if he's going to tax them.
No. The point is, he's not necessarily going to stick.
He'll have to make commitments to tax the super rich.
He will. Well, they've already said they're going to get rid of non-dom status and so on, which is symbolic, and it's not a lot of money, but I mean, he knows that he's got to do that. He's also said they're going to abolish the House of Lords, for example, which is a way of trying to mollify people like me who want to change in the electoral system. Now, we will see what happens, because I think what's going to happen in Bristol is pretty clear. I think Fangham Debonair will remain as Bristol West MP, but a majority will be greatly reduced.
The Greens may do very well.
Yes, but the Greens, even if they do very, very well in Bristol West and take the seat, which is just about feasible, that just gives them two MPs instead of one MP.
Generally speaking, I
which
think
of course doesn't change anything
a lot
much
of people
at all.
See, well, we maybe even get Marvin Rees standing, mightn't we?
I doubt it, because
he said he might stand in the North West. Bristol North West. So what about Wes Streeting? I find a fascinating figure, because the political parties, the way they work, they always have these kind of political scouts or outriders who are put out there in order to see if they're going to get their heads blown off when they come up with all these ridiculous or maybe more radical policies. Starmer can't say it because he may get, as I say, may get his head blown off. But Wes Streeting seems to be the guy who toughs out these difficult interviews. He's split the party, apparently, Martin, over calls for the National Health Service to reform or die. That's what Streeting is saying. Well, so in a way, this is his way of saying, this is what we're going to do about the NHS. We're not going to back it with money taxing the rich. No, we're going to reform it.
Yeah, well, this is a very, you know, we know because of the experience of New Labour, we know what this means.
Well, the word
it means
of reform,
that the privatisation of the health service, which has been the long-term plan of the Conservative Party, is not going to be seriously stopped by the Labour Party. Don't forget, it was the Labour Party that brought in the private finance initiative for hospitals and so on, so that getting the private sector's feet under the table.
A couple of things Wes wants to do, and he's obviously a favoured person by the city and by the establishment, and by much of the press, is that he wants to phase out the existing GP system. Well, a lot of people would say it's kind of broken, so we need to do something. You're going to make it work? No, he wants to phase it out. And also, he wants private hospitals to help tackle the NHS backlog.
Yes, so in other words, whatever you vote for, whether you're voting for the Tories or for the Labour Party, you're voting for the continued undermining of the whole NHS principle. But of course, in Scotland, the SNP are going to say, no, we're not having any of that. And they will be looking to take votes saying, we will protect the health service in Scotland. And of course, the Labour in Wales will not necessarily go along with that either. So we know what's happening. New Labour, and that's what this is, they are in the pockets of big capital and the deep state. But what surprise is there? I'm not surprised by anything they're saying. I'm opposed to what they're saying. But don't be surprised that they're saying
Streeting
it.
Streeting has been the Labour Party's main person criticising the health union. So he's not saying they should be paid more. He's saying that they should not strike and that, for example, he's accused one of the health unions of doing a doctors a disservice as he doubled down on his fight with the health unions.
Yes, and in other words, the Labour Party leadership are trying to show the conservative establishment, you know, the City of London, all the people I've just mentioned, that they will carry on, you know, they're going to be a safe pair of hands for the continued privatisation and all the rest of it. But of course, what they're going to find if they come to power is they're going to run into a baseball bat called world economic crisis, and they won't be able to do a lot of what they want to do unless they're going to, you know, radical right wing policies from a left perspective.
Apparently, Labour, this is according to Streeting again, won't raise taxes for middle earners to bankroll the NHS. So he's okay. Actual quote is he won't raise taxes to bankroll the NHS.
Yeah. So in other words, what they're doing
this was a kind of Liz Truss line.
Well,
we don't want to increase taxes.
It's a nice cop, nasty cop routine, isn't it? So the Tories say, we're going to break your legs, we're going to smash the National Health Service, we're going to completely privatise it. And the Labour Party comes along and says, gives us a cup of coffee and a fag, and says, look, we're not going to break your legs, but we're still going to privatise it.
And
we just go, yes, all right, then, just sign here.
Took place a month ago. He was saying, actually, Wes Streeting wants a war on the hostile health unions.
Well, this is extraordinary. I mean, I know why he's saying it, and I resent it, but it just shows how confident the right wing of the Labour Party has become. Because in the past, the unions funded the Labour Party, but of course, during the Blair era, they got more money from people like Lord Sainsbury than they got from the Transport and General Workers Union. So they want to create a party like the Democrat Party in the United States, which is funded by billionaires. And of course, what we really need is a Scandinavian style setup with proportional representation and party political funding from the state, which keeps it doesn't stop the wealthy having a lot of power, but it keeps them off the pitch.
Look, back to Mandelson finally, and what about his thing about he's got his mojo? He's nearly got his mojo. This is a sort of I suppose this is what we were talking about, personality. You know, like Boris had a mojo for a while, then he lost it. And Peter Mandelson says that Keir Starmer nearly has got his mojo back.
Well, what we're talking about is Starmer is being groomed to be PM by the Labour Party and by the establishment. The Tories are... But I mean, lots of Tory MPs, even young ones like Chris Skidmore up the road here
Kingswood
are resigning because they know there's no future for them, and at that point, you know, the Labour Party is going to run the country, but it's going to run it as if it was the Tory
and
party.
What about the statement that nobody is questioning him? And you know, this to me sounds very bizarre, that the Mandelson, you know, maybe it's true that in the Labour Party he's created the atmosphere where nobody questions Keir.
Well, what's happened is lots of people have resigned from the Labour Party, hundreds of thousands of them who joined. I've been a member since the Jurassic period, but these people joined and now they've all left. So of course there is no criticism from those people within the party because they're no longer in the Labour Party. What will happen in Bristol is those people will vote Green. That's what will happen. But of course that's not a real threat in other parts of the country. There's a tendency for the left, just as on the right, to think that everybody thinks like you do, and it's not necessarily the case. People are largely brainwashed by the media they watch, and the kind, you know, throughout most of history, people have supported their bosses because their bosses are the ones who provide work for them, and they, you know, they defer to them. It's very rare that you get challenges develop, but it takes a long time.
Okay, in the period around about, I think it was October, November last year, we had this thing called the Mayor's Annual State of the City Address 2022. That's our Mayor, Marvin Rees, the Blairite Labour Mayor. And rather than actually hear what, I mean, I think at the time we had a couple of clips from that speech, but I was interested to look at how this whole idea of business and local government operates, and it's quite clear how it does. If you've ever been anything to do with these partnerships, so-called partnerships, I was had the dubious honour of being from the mid-noughties to the end of the noughties sat as a In fact, probably if you go to Companies House and look at the old records for Bristol Cultural Development Partnership, you'll find me on there for a few years. I wasn't asked whether I wanted to leave, although I was elected on there from VOSCA, which was the voluntary sector of Bristol. I was just removed by a chap called Andrew Kelly. Andrew Kelly being the guy who is the full-time worker at the Bristol Cultural Development Partnership. So the way these things work, this partnership works, is the entire organisation was run by Business West, and a Business West representative on there and often chairing the meetings was a guy called John Savage. This is really the local Chamber of Commerce, and yet it was three-way funded, half by... A third by Business West, a third by local government, and a third by Arts Council at central government. So that's the way these things operate. And yet the entire thing was run by a guy called Andrew Kelly, and who was line managed by John Savage from Business West. So the idea of these partnerships, Martin, is to have big business deciding everything, but being paid for, two-thirds of the organisation being paid for by local government and central government.
Yes, that's the way these things work, isn't it? And if you want to change that, you see, if you're going to change that, there used to be things called regional development agencies, didn't there? Which were actually more, you know, business was kept at arm's length from those. But of course, what's happened over the years is business became, you know, all the government has got to be like business. Now, there used to be a fairly robust attitude that these two things weren't the same at all, that public resources and public public activity wasn't the same as business. And that in actual fact, there was a tension between business interests and public interest, which is why civil servants, for example, weren't allowed to work for the private sector and vice versa. But of course, what happened with the third way? You remember the third way? The whole idea that all we want is competence and we'll get a committee together where the business people can talk to the government people and they all work together in the interest. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't listen to the interests of business, but you've got to have a pretty, you know, if you're going to sup with the devil, you've got to take a long spoon. And when the Labour government in the 40s and 50s the 40s mainly, basically business was told what to do. They didn't like it. They were just told, we're doing this. And of course, they were in such a weak position that they couldn't argue. And even in the 60s, there was a clear division made between business interests and ordinary interests. And there used to be an understanding in the population that business people don't necessarily have your best interests at heart. But the propaganda we've got now with, you know, Dragon's Den and all the rest of it, business, 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 business. Everybody thinks that business is somehow on their side. In the past, people had a much more robust attitude. They knew that business people were not on their side. And we've got to get back to that understanding. And I think that is beginning to happen with these strikes, because the population at large is not directly involved in the strikes, although they're affected by them, but they're beginning to realise that the people in charge don't have their best interests at heart. That's good.
Just to give you an insight into the board of Bristol Cultural Development Partnership, there was a chap on the board who was the Director of Cultural Services at Bristol City Council. I think he was, as a council officer, one tier down from the very top of the council officers, and he was a really good, genuine public service inspired public servant. He would go out around the city organising things like art shows all around the fringes of the city, sometimes in the city centre, trying to make sure that artists who lived in the city got an opportunity to use council exhibition space for their own work. And it was him that pointed out to me that John Savage had been the former master of the Merchant Venturers, so that he was involved in this kind of Bristol Illuminati group that's been going for hundreds of years and was involved in colonisation of the United States, the exploitation of the US, which by implication means part of the genocide of Native Americans. And then, of course, much more notoriously with Edward Colston, the slave trade itself afterwards. So the idea that these people are actually they're not only still around, they're now, Martin, in the driving seat, and they're being funded. At least more than half of their funding is coming from the public sector. It's almost unbelievable.
Well, let's face it, throughout the Middle Ages and well into the modern era, the merchant venturers were the government of Bristol, quite literally. They were.
Maybe they still are.
Well, of course, that's exactly.
If they own the city, then I suppose they feel the right to decide.
Well, there you are. I mean, the people who own everything do tend to be in charge.
One of the things that's, I think, fascinating about the merchants is it's impossible to find out whereabouts their investments are, but you can spot their members popping up on boards around the country, like Wales and West Utilities, like the Bristol Post. So you know where their investments are because, that, you know, as a large shareholder of any organisation, they're entitled to nominate people onto the board, Martin.
Well, if you remember, the only time the Merchant Ventures came on our show was when Chris Covington, I think it was, came in, because they elect somebody to be a chief merchant venturer every year, and he'd just been elected.
Yes, that's right. This is worth mentioning. The master of the merchant venturers is like not the master of the ship or something, or the master of the lodge. They also have various names that they give to it's the senior warden and the junior warden. So the senior warden is next year's master, the junior warden is master in 2 years' time. These terms are taken directly from Freemasonry.
Undoubtedly so, Tony. But anyway, he came in, and perhaps I'll put it to you that you should put a link to that interview up on today's show page, if you can find it from our archive.
Yeah.
Because that's the only time ever had them come in. And as it luck wouldn't have it from his point of view, because, of course, you managed to blag him onto the thing, and then his PR people said he shouldn't go on that show.
Right.
But anyway, he turned up, and, of course, it turned out that he was on the board of Bristol Water as a lawyer, or as working as a lawyer for Bristol Water, and they just had the biggest fine ever for overcharging and other things.
Yeah, and they'd had their accounts refused.
Yes,
there was a massive amount of money they wanted to spend.
This
is by Ofwat, the regulators.
Yes, the regulators. And he actually gave us a bit of an insider's view. He said, well, we're going to challenge that stuff in court, and it won't stand. And sure enough, that's exactly what he did. He challenged it in court, and it didn't stand.
He himself was a corporate lawyer, wasn't he?
That's right. He's a corporate lawyer. Mm. And of course, the things like Bristol Water wasn't privatised. It's always been run by the merchant venturers going back for a long time.
Talking of which, these types now seem to be in charge at the city council here rather than people we elect. We had Ruth... Nesta on this programme before Christmas, talking about how the City Council Legal Department have used the insolvency courts, which are supposed to be there for the Proceeds of Crime Act, which is only supposed to apply for serious crime, because she hadn't paid her council tax. They said she hadn't paid her council tax, and so they accuse her of a serious organised crime of some sort, and they're trying to take her house off her, and it was actually her own house. So what they're doing is they're abusing the law, and they're using, I would imagine, people like Chris Cowley, or whatever his name was, in order to do that. But anyway, it wasn't Covington, it definitely wasn't. But anyway, the Mayor's Annual State of the City address from last year. Now let's have a listen to the guy who's behind that whole cultural development partnership, and also the what they call the Festival of Ideas, which I nickname the Festival of Bad Ideas, because they never seem to have anybody really radical anywhere near that organisation, anywhere near those events. Andrew Kelly is his name. I remember he was dishing out public money to his wife or his partner at the time as well, getting her to do loads of stuff for the Cultural Development Partnership. She was an author, but I think it's totally unacceptable for you to be dishing it out to your mates. But that actually is the culture that this gangsterism has created amongst the business community, is we just give money to our mates, and there's no real democracy involved anymore. So let's have a listen to this. This is the introduction to the Mayor's Annual State of the City address last year by one Andrew Kelly, who's line managed by John Savage, former master of the Merchant Venturers and pincher of the public funds.
Thank you very much, Kat. It's always a big treat to have our city poets read for us at this event and also work with us through the year. I'm Andrew Kelly from Bristol Ideas, and I'll be hosting the rest of the evening. I'm just going to run through quickly what's going to happen. We're going to have our youth mayors speak next, Annika Mistry and Jeremiah Domogbonna, and we'll bring those up soon, and then be followed by Mayor Marvin Rees's State of the City address. And following that, Marvin will join two guests we have from Nigeria and Canada. This is part of a international project that we're working on this year, and they'll be answering some of the questions that were submitted by some of the members of this audience tonight. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later. Just before I do that, I wanted to introduce Naomi and Karina, our two signers, who are doing a fantastic job in BSL language tonight. So could we welcome to the stage Annika Mistry and Jeremiah Domogbonner.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Annika, and I am one of the youth mayors of Bristol. I am 14 years old, and I'm currently in Year 10 at CST Trinity Academy, one of Bristol's newest secondary schools, which you may have heard some fabulous things about already, where I'm starting my GCSE courses, which I'm really, really enjoying.
So, produced by Andrew Kelly, announced by Andrew Kelly, this is the new face of the corporate culture, which is really actually controlled by big business.
Yes, but at the same time, can you see all of the, you know, we've got youth mayors, signing, inclusion, but at the same time, underlying all of this is Bristol is a brutally unfair city, like many of our cities.
This is one of the things that annoys me about these people, like Kelly, is they are all the time going on about equality, etc. But actually, when it comes to economic equality, they're not interested.
Well, I think what you'll find is that the tools for creating economic equality have been removed. Councils used to house most of the population through council housing in their area. It gave them huge leverage over what went on. That was all taken away. They used to run the bus services. That was all taken away. So all that's left is a lot of weak rhetoric about inclusion, because the actual power to do things, the rating system was much fairer than the council tax system. All of these things, if Labour are serious about changing the way local government works, they've got to get rid of the Tory reforms of the last 40 years. But they're not talking about that at all, are they?
They've also got to make sure that the tax collection at the Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs is restored to the regions, because this is exactly what the gangsters in Kiev did after 2014, is they turned off the tap. So they made sure that the money that they're collecting in nationally, as little as possible, went out to the regions.
Yes, but at the same time, if you've got a centralised state, if it's done properly, you can make sure that weaker regions are subsidised by stronger regions, because the central government insists on it.
Well, that's not happening here.
That's what used to happen in the United Kingdom, when Scotland solidly voted Tory. They used to vote Tory at one stage, but they solidly voted Labour because the redistribution system worked. And it bound them into the United Kingdom. But the Tory, forcing poll tax on them against their will, reducing their expenditures and so on, that eventually they say, well, we'll go off on our own. But ultimately, all regions of any country or any bigger entity like the European Union, they're all in competition with each other, and big business is just playing one off against the other. And so that's a big problem.
It's a big market, isn't it, they've created?
Well, it's a big global market as well. It's not just within Europe. You know, there used to be, when British Gas was British, it would only operate within Britain. You know, the same with British Leyland, which wasn't a very successful company, but it was owned by the British government. All of that's gone. And so the levers that used to allow redistribution just aren't there anymore. Now, what Mandelson and all these other right-wing Labour people say, well, we can't go back to nationalisation. If you like saying, well, why not? It's the obvious solution to the problem in the railways, for example. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. They won't accept that, in actual fact, everything that's been done during the Thatcher era, which is 40 years, has been wrong. And if we just went back to what we did at 40 years ago, in many respects, that would be better. It wouldn't be enough, but it would be better.
Don't know if you remember I interviewed Kees van der Peel, the author of The Atlantic Ruling Class, and his more recent book, The Pandemic of Angst, Martin, where he says, look, we know that in the West, these big corporations are taking over, that they're denuding democracy, that people are going to get poor, possibly starve. And so what we want to do is to adjust everything to make sure that there are no routes for them to try and take over various routes of protest, to introduce new laws to stop protest. And of course, that's been happening. So there's all sorts of little groups out there, NGOs, I suppose you could call them, in order to try and cheer us up as we're being shafted by the World Economic Forum and the elite. So one of the programmes we did here, oh gosh, must be about 4 or 5 years ago, was with a guy called Sam Downey on the Dialect Show, and I had a clip from it on the main programme that we were doing from Eastern Community Centre on FM at that point, with Sam Downey and Viran Patel. And they look at this organisation called Happy City, Bristol Happy City, which our sound engineer Dave pointed out that Barack Obama at the time was actually following their Twitter feed. So obviously some people in the know think, well, this is a great... Anyway, as a result of that program, the Happy City people put in a complaint about it, and we had to remove it from the internet. Got a rap knuckles from the Bristol Mafia at the time. So Sam Downey, let's have a listen to him now, talking about this Happy City organization and how they want to do national resilience training with the United States Army. One of the things you've looked into is this resilience training army. Now, who are they?
You've got happiness and well-being, and it all feeds back to a university in America, Pennsylvania University, and they designed, as part of well-being and happiness, the resilience training for the U.S. Army. So since 2009, the university has been working with the United States Army. And this is a professor from the university called Martin Seligman. I usually pronounce that wrong, but people in positive psychology, which is what this is based on, usually hit me or do nasty things if you pronounce a guru's name wrong. The guru behind it all, yeah. So Professor Martin Seligman.
Oh dear. begins to sound like a cult. Anyway, I'd like to bring Viran in, Viran Patel here. You're a social justice campaigner, Viran. I wonder what you make of what we've heard so far and how it links up with economics and productivity.
Well, I think there's a broad range of manipulation going on here by what I see as the models that Sam has described and what the government's trying to do. If you look at happiness, that as a concept in itself is really something that you can't define and I can't define for each other. So I might like Marmite, you might hate Marmite, and vice versa. So if you look at it in a broader scale and put it into economics, well, what they're trying to do is say, how much money does one need to be productive in the environment and also to make sure that they benefit the economic system that we're living in at the moment? And that economic system is based on tax, based on the fiat currency, based on house prices going up.
So you say the fiat currency, what do you mean by that term?
Well, it's money that's printed by the banks because the central bank says we're going to give you a pound. And if we give you a pound to, say, for example, NatWest or any other high street bank, you can print 10 more of those pounds and charge them out as interest.
Right, basically. So there is what you're saying effectively, and I mean there's more and more people saying the same, yeah, is that money is basically a kind of contract, a fiction.
At the moment it is, yeah. The way it's been set up, the system is that way.
The banks can just make it up out of nowhere. That's almost like a magician clicking their fingers and making money up out of nowhere.
Well, exactly. And so my issue is really coming to where we are now in the economic injustice that we see around the world.
Because, I mean, the theory here is that if you can make money out of nowhere, well, why not just give it to people that need it?
Well, exactly. And that's the point. But that's not what this model looks at, realistically. What I see this model doing, so there's two specific ones in the model that Sam talked about, which was looking at connecting with people, and the other one is giving. Well, if you're a poor person on the street who has no house, who has no income, how can you give anything apart from being that person on the street?
Well, imagine they will say, well, you can give of yourself.
Well, exactly, but how much more can that person give, really, if they're not able to be a productive member of society that is able to produce something that people see as a productive value, or the government sees as productive value? So really, it's putting the onus on the individual that they must be creating their happiness and creating their welfare, when actually there's a larger system out there that actually should be giving more to people and providing social justice.
Well, we've now got in Bristol something called Bristol Resilience. I mean, that was formed about a year and a half after that interview, Martin, which is supposed to, what it's supposed to do is to make sure that the city is able to survive various problems that might come its way. They have a new, more resilient Bristol, they call it. Well, they don't really specify much about what it is. On the council's website, they have something saying the Bristol Resilience Strategy is a dynamic vision for how Bristol can look 50 years from now. It provides a framework for action to protect the city against potential shocks and stresses it may encounter. It aims to tackle some of Bristol's, of course, it's not necessarily going to tackle it, it just aims to tackle some of Bristol's major issues, including traffic congestion, affordable housing, poor air quality and child poverty. Well, that all sounds great, but all of these indices are going up in problematically, you know, or down, you might say, rather than being actually addressed, aren't they? I mean, affordable housing isn't really affordable. This is just a silly word. Traffic congestion is getting far worse at the moment. With all these road closures being introduced and the clean air zone causing massive congestion around the edges of the clean air zone. And child poverty, of course, as right across the nation is going up, with something like now one in three children growing up in poverty. They've done really nothing, it seems. And this is all talk.
Well, maybe at the level of Bristol and at the level of non-governmental organisations, you can't do anything. You've actually got to change the economic system at a national and international level. And of course, all of this stuff is very accepting of the status quo. And we've just got to work within the status quo. But and that's all
tens,
we can do.
Tens, actually, no, hundreds of thousands of pounds every year going into the Bristol Resilience Group. They also call themselves... they are retweeting something else, which isn't called Bristol Resilience. It's called Bristol Innovators Group. Ah, so this is business, really. These are the people who are apparently going to create new businesses. This seems to me is really just a branch of Business West.
Well, what you've got here is this third way ideology, haven't you? Which is that we can't do what we used to do, which is just provide council housing and public transport provided by the public authority. Obviously, Thatcher got rid of all of that, and we can't go back to that terrible stuff. So we now got to reinvent the wheel and come up with various ways to try and deal with poverty, but we haven't really got the means, so we've got loads of hot air instead.
What about happy city and positive psychology?
Well, you know, that's the whole thing, isn't it? It's like mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. But of course, underpinning all of this is the neoliberal ideology of you've got to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, whether as an individual or as a city or whatever. We need changes in national policy in Britain, and they've got to be coordinated with other national policy changes with our neighbours and internationally. That's where international geopolitics comes in and all the rest of it. The developing countries, for example, if you really wanted to help them deal with the problems of climate change, you could abolish their international debts, which means that the banking system in the West would have to be nationalised. But if we're not talking about any of that, we're talking about why don't we bring in electric cars in Brazil?
Well, right, or block off Bristol city centre and actually say that any small business like gardeners and people like that want to drive near the city centre have got to pay an extra $3,500 a year in tax.
Well,
that's not really helping small businesses, is it?
No, but maybe these small businesses shouldn't exist, Tony. There's a tendency for small businesses to think that they've got a right to exist. But if they can't make a profit in a capitalist society, they haven't got a right to exist.
They can't if they're taxed $3,500 a year just for existing. And and also, of course, there is always some sort of big gardening chain funded by a private equity firm that can take over from them.
Yes, all right, but I mean, I think what you're doing is you're comparing apples and oranges. There's a debate to be had about whether we should close off Bristol city centre, but the general philosophy of the third way...
Well, it's helping congestion, isn't it?
Yes, well, maybe...
Supposedly.
Yes, I know, but the point about this, Tony, is that's a specific policy.
Are they two completely separate ideas,
then? No,
they're
not completely separate, but it's just one tiny component. The real problem is the way the whole system works. The whole system. The fact that people have got to have bank accounts run by private banks,
to me,
for example,
this whole
which charge interest to the people.
This whole
all
resilience,
of these things have got to be changed.
It seems to me the whole resilience group, whoever they are, an innovation hub, whoever they are, is actually making things worse, not better.
Well, what they are is at the very best, they're achieving very little, and at the worst, they're making things worse. But in actual fact, it's marginal compared to things like the rules for universal credit payments, which are decided at national level.
Well, no, these are the things that really matter. All the things that are being implemented in cities like Bristol don't actually do make things worse. And one of the things behind a lot of this is the Sustainable Development Goals for Agenda 2030. It used to be called Agenda 21. It's now been expanded into something called Agenda 2030. It's part of the UN, but it's only really part of the UN because of the way that the World Economic Forum 3 years ago did effectively a hostile takeover bid on the United Nations. So you've got these, when we've been talking about this competition between democratic institutions and public money with big business round here, Martin, in Bristol. But this is also happening on an international level, isn't it? The UN is running out of money. The World Economic Forum have come along and said, it's okay, we've got plenty. Let's do a deal.
Yes, well, that's right. And that's and one of the reasons for that is that the United States doesn't pay its contributions to the UN. They're the biggest contributors and they don't pay.
Look, it's not just the US, is it? Most countries are finding it difficult to make ends meet nationally because their economies are collapsing effectively because of finance capitalism. If they stuck to industrial capitalism, they'd probably be okay.
Some countries haven't got industrial capitalism.
The West doesn't have industrial capitalism?
No, I'm talking
capitalism.
About the UN covers lots of places. It covers Bangladesh, for example, which does have some industry, garment industry and so on.
Where the WEF are powerful, most of those countries are, you know,
The UN system is supposed to be a Westphalian system, which means that each country has equal power and respect, no matter how big or small or rich or poor.
Well, I think the Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians, etc., do raise their eyebrows somewhat at the World Economic Forum taking over the UN, don't they?
Well, they certainly do. And in actual fact, the World Economic Forum and the UN, as run by the West, is being challenged by an alternative Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS Alliance. And they are going to pursue industrial capitalism, and they're going, I mean, what's going to happen in Europe now, Tony, with what's going on, we're going to come to this in the second part, is Western Europe and Eastern Europe are going to collapse economically. The German economy, which has been central to the European economy since World War II, is going to be gutted. And the beneficiaries in the short run are going to be big capitalists in the United States and corporations in the United States. In the long run, or even in the medium term, the banking system is going to collapse. And, of course, the question then is whether the Chinese and Russian banking system is sufficiently insulated from that.
I suspect
they are.
After the break, when we hear from Putin and his New Year's speech, there, I think you'll be kind of justified in exactly what you're saying there. But anyway, Rosa Corrie died a year before last. That was in 2020. But she had a lot to say about smart cities, and in fact, I don't know if you could call her an equivalent, but Sandy Adams down in Glastonbury has also done a lot of analysis on what does this Agenda 2030, which is so pushed by the World Economic Forum, by Klaus Schwab, by King Charles, really means is that we're going to get these smart cities. She sees it actually as really coming from the far right, even though it's now being rolled out through the UN.
The U.S. landmass is about 2.5 times the size of Europe and has roughly half the population, just over half. That landmass is huge, and about 75% of the population lives in large cities. The goal is to move everyone out of the rural areas and into the large cities, and to destroy representative government and to move it into government by unelected boards and commissions. Now, here in the EU, of course, you've already moved to that position, where it's an erasure of jurisdictional boundaries, an erasure of national boundaries. And that is the goal, because, as Zbigniew Brzezinski said in 1995, you can't just impose globalization pell-mell as a total movement. You have to do it incrementally, and the way to do that is through regionalization. And in Denmark, every nation that signed on to Agenda 21 has its local Agenda 21 plan. People in the United States are completely unaware of this. If I go out and talk about this, the United States press will attack me and calls me a conspiracy theorist, which is totally ridiculous. It is a conspiracy, but it's not a theory. It's a fact. Here in Europe, it's openly spoken about, local Agenda 21. And, of course, here in Denmark, the Aalborg principles, 1994, and then Aalborg plus 10, 2004, was the European roundtable for local Agenda 21 was held here. And the principles are public-private partnerships, which is fascism. And this is how it's implemented on the ground, is through this joining together between corporations, non-governmental organizations, and governments in order to cut out the, you know, the actual individual, your voter, and instead to take that to a level where we literally cannot penetrate. And this is the goal. So this is already far progressed in Europe. The three pillars of United Nations Agenda 21 are economy, ecology, and equity, the three E's, the social equity. And everyone sort of thinks that they know what that means, the idea of social equity. It must mean that, well, everyone's going to have access to clean water and clean air, and no one's property is going to be used as a dumping ground because they are at a poverty level. But really what social equity is about impoverishing huge portions of the population and bringing down the developed nations. And while this sounds like, you know, it sounds almost like in the United States you'd call that a right-wing point of view, a conservative right-wing point of view. I personally am a liberal. The idea that that's something this drastic, this radical, would be happening worldwide without people knowing it. All you have to do is look at austerity measures, restrictions on transfers of wealth, additional restrictions on land use, ability, you know, to produce, to use your energy, your water, your industry. All of this is happening in developed nations. So when you have your infrastructure attacked like that, it's going to have a tremendous impact on your ability to prosper, as well as the idea that that everything that we're looking at now is destined to collapse our economies. Because the idea, what, you know, this is a corporatocracy. It's a totalitarian state being developed right now all over the world. And what major corporations want in this fascist development is to be able to have full movement of workers without borders or boundaries, to be able to move their goods through without regulations, and to reduce wages. And so this is the goal. So this is what you find with social equity. That's code for social equity for this movement and reduction of the population. So, and of course, economy and ecology is about bringing into balance economy. These are the three circles: economy, ecology, and social equity. And where they meet in the center is balance. But really that balance is a communitarian balance. So it's not balance of well-being of the people. What it is it's a balance for corporations so that they can exploit and control and have populations in an area in tightly packed, dense areas so that they can be surveilled and managed. And this is what that balance looks like as far as the development of a totalitarian state is.
Rosa Corrie there, speaking not long before she died in 2021 about this whole idea of smart cities and Agenda 2030. It's called, I think, called Smart Cities, Fascist United Nations and Agenda 2030 Exposed. Deleted from YouTube, but still there on BitChute, you know, which we had a piece about just before Christmas about supporting them as HSBC had taken away their money, stolen their money. So all sorts in there, Martin. Maybe you could just start by saying, what does she mean by communitarianism? That's a word you don't often hear these days.
Well, I don't know. The problem is, if she uses words like that, people don't know what she means. Mm. And that's the problem, is that there's a lot of stuff in there. But it, and but it, she's there's not enough detail
in
for
a way,
me to
in
say
a way,
well, what is she really
she's sort
talking
of talking about?
About
this is communist and this is fascist at the same time.
Yes, in other words, she is coming out with the UN is some kind that the UN is a very flawed institution. It's basically been subverted by the United States, not least because the United States don't pay their dues to the UN.
Look,
the UN is based in New York for a reason, because then
Geneva.
They,
that,
No, the UN headquarters is in New York.
I know, they say it's Geneva, but actually it isn't. So,
and in other words, they can at any point the Americans can control who can and can't. Russian diplomats weren't allowed to go there.
Nat Rothschild's got his own branch of the UN down in Geneva. Yeah. But anyway, look, I mean, the idea here is, look, let's just look at this as something which is some sort of weird blend between communism and fascism. To me, it's not communism. It's communistic ideas taken over by fascists, basically, by big business, by corporations, individuals who are behind the shield of these big banks and big companies.
The big money people in the West want to retain their power. And in order to retain their power, they've got to pretend that they're just there to help you. Mm. Business isn't an enemy, Tony. Business
Well, they sell their products, don't they, to people, even though they poison them, they still manage to sell them.
But they want people to think of them as... the fourth industrial revolution is the way to save the planet. Not revolution, of course, Tony. We don't need a revolution. We don't need any political changes.
We don't want Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn wasn't promising a revolution either. No. But even he was within this consensus. Ultimately, the only way we're going to get a better future is through massive political changes. And all of this huff and puff about equity...
But those political changes are going to come anyway, aren't they? Because of the crises that are coming down the road.
Yeah, but the danger with the crises is we won't... You see, in the 19th century, there was actually a belief in human progress as inevitable. So the communists, like Karl Marx, believed that society would inevitably have a revolution which would inevitably lead to human progress. We don't think like that anymore, and quite rightly. The danger with what's going to happen now is that we won't get to a totalitarian state where we're all being surveyed. The number one danger, I stress week after week, is a nuclear war. The second danger is financial collapse, which then leads to civil war all over the world, and then lots of people get killed. Well, it's not a totalitarian state. It's a chaotic state.
Well, what Rose, chaos, which is what they love, isn't it? Ordo ab chaos.
Well,
creating order from the chaos. And in fact, we know through Naomi Klein that the more chaos you can create, the more you can control the outcome.
Ultimately, the danger we're facing now in 2023 is that even in this year, the next 12 months, the chaos will overwhelm even the people that created the chaos. Because chaos is the real chaos is going to be chaotic, and they won't be able to control it. So the fear that people have that we're going to wake up in a totalitarian state, I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's not the immediate threat. The immediate threat is that we're going to destroy ourselves through stupidity.
Mm. Well, that may be deliberate, I think, rather than just simply stupid. What she's talking about there, really, is a world where people are deliberately impoverished. Millions, billions even, of people have been deliberately impoverished to take away their ability to act in society and to do revolutions, the sort of political protest that you are describing there. And, of course, they can't do that if they've got no resources. They're trying desperately to make enough money to live
on. She's speaking as an American in Denmark. In Brazil, the struggle is to create a democracy, because it's never been a democracy. It's not that they're going to take it away from you.
Can we just take it in the context that she's putting it, right? She's not talking about Brazil specifically, although that's a side issue when it comes to Agenda 2030. She's effectively saying, well, you know, during the Industrial Revolution, people were herded into cities, weren't they? They were put into the situation where they had no money. They had to go and work in factories in this country. And that was one of the the drivers of the Industrial Revolution, was all this cheap labour that was desperate to make some money and feed their kids.
Well, if you look at the way... let's compare Brazil with China. In China, they still have...
Let me think about the UK.
You're talking about the UK in the 19th century.
She is talking about Europe, Martin.
She's not talking about China or Brazil. Europe only became a developed society because it was based on imperialism. Britain is a powerful country because we robbed the whole world to become a powerful country. And you can't say that was accidental. The possession of India was decisive.
I question how powerful Britain is now.
Well, it's not.
I don't think it is powerful.
No, it's not. But it's more powerful than countries which we and the Americans tell what to do.
The establishment like to think they are.
No, I know the establishment in Britain is a junior establishment to the to to the to, to the US. But the city of London is still far more powerful than, in many ways, than New York. And the elite in Britain is part of the global elite. I mean, once Margaret Thatcher left power, she went to live in Texas, because that's where she spent most of her time. The global elite, like Rupert Murdoch from Australia, runs all the newspapers in Britain, which are very jingoistic. He's actually an American citizen now. These are these kind of people, yeah? They run the world. And, of course, the idea that we've had democracy and it's being taken away, many countries in the world, they've never had it. It's a struggle. It's a fight. And, of course, more people were living in cities on this planet than were living in rural areas for the first time in human history. Happened.
I mean, she's saying
ago,
it's going to be what Rose is saying is actually what Agenda 2030 really means is even more people are going to be. I mean, it sounds to me as if they're kind of trying to herd people into these cities and then farm them, use them for their own, you know, impoverish them.
You know what the answer to that is? It's land reform. In big countries like Brazil, which they already had, in Japan and South Korea and Taiwan, which is why they became the Southeast Asian
tigers. What
about
Belarus?
Belarus, they don't need land reform because the land in Belarus belongs to the Belarusian government, and it's actually, they've still got the old collective farm system. And Lukashenko was a collective farm manager. And instead of privatizing, as they did in Russia and Lithuania, which are the, you know, neighboring countries, they kept the collective farm system going, and it actually works.
Book your holidays
properly.
Book your holidays in Belarus, folks.
And that's one of the reasons why Lukashenko did win the last election. But there's only 10 million people in Belarus.
Because the
people in the rural areas know that they're being looked after.
If you're fed up
their
with
jobs
paying,
their jobs are secure.
If you're fed up with paying the Clean Air Zone charges, you could probably just drive over to Belarus and have a nice holiday over there. It'd be very interesting to see how what life is like. I remember when I went to Russia in 2015, it was fascinating to look at the sort of leftovers of the collective farms that the Russians had, and also these kind of dacha. They were like massive allotments. Almost everybody in the cities had one, and I guess you would have about 2 or 3 acres maybe with your dacha, Martin. The system over there is pretty good, really. You know, the idea is that everyone needs in the summer somewhere to get away from the city too, and that's where people went. And actually, it was a brilliant way to be growing food during, you know, the early 1990s, when people just, when the economy collapsed and people didn't have any food. There was no food.
Yeah, but in I saw a World Bank report, or a draft World Bank report, which I then went to debate with the World Bank, and there was a very good section in it about the collapse of the rural economy across Eastern Europe, but particularly in Russia. And the dismantling of the collective farm system was actually vandalism in many respects. It left people far worse off than they were before. And there was no what's happened in Russia since 2014 is they've rebuilt the it's not the collective farm system, they've privatized it, but it's still they've basically rebuilt their own farming system, which was destroyed by the neoliberal reforms of the 1990s.
Maybe it wasn't collective farms that I saw.
No,
it
you're
was,
looking at dachas, which is a different thing.
It was, in terms of acres, there would be about 200 properties with a fence around it, massive. Each place had about 2 or 3 acres of land, and they cultivated their own land. Of course, they don't have a very long summer in Russia.
No.
But there they were out in the fields, and this was something which was seen as a kind of, you know, this is real resilience. We're talking in Bristol about resilience. How do people survive in crises? That's how they survive, is by making sure that they've got access to land and they've got access to food if the world economy goes down the tubes, or as in that case in the 90s, the Russian economy.
Yes, well, one of the things that makes the Chinese economy resilient is that they've still got a lot of people living in rural areas. And they've got the they've now got the personal responsibility system. And life in
You mean the social credit?
No,
I mean
the personal,
do as you're told
the personal responsibility system in terms of farming, Tony, because they used to have collective communes, which were not very effective at all, ultimately, and caused a massive famine in the Great Leap Forward of the 1950s. The Dengist reforms in the 1990s allowed people to have family farms again, although the land still belongs to the state and they rent it from the state. Now, the point is that they've still got a large, effective rural economy, and they can take, as time goes on, they can take people from that rural economy, move them into the urban economy, or even move the industry into the rural areas. The township and village enterprise system in China has created lots of small rural industries to provide extra employment. Now that's exactly what is lacking in a place like Brazil, where all the land belongs to the Spanish conquistadors who took it by force 500 years ago.
Though. We're actually talking about Europe and the UK, Martin. But anyway,
we're talking about the UN, which includes everybody.
We're talking about the UK and we're talking about Europe. That's what Rosa Crowe is talking about specifically.
That's what
we're talking about. I realise that. You know, you're talking about something different. Now, look, can we just please focus on whether or not... Okay, fine, but that's what we're doing. We're looking at Europe, and that's where we live, and that's where the programme's coming from. And we're not talking about Brazil, we're not talking about China specifically. How a rural Welsh village became the focal point of a bitter row over tree planting. Now, this is an excellent piece on ITV's National News a couple of days ago by Rhys Williams, their Wales reporter, which proves really what Rosa Corrie's saying is correct. One family is hit by the unintended consequences of government green policies. Well, I wouldn't say necessarily unintended. He's being very kind to them there. The area's economy in this rural village in Carmarthenshire, the Cothi Valley, is built around farming. The northern end of this predominantly Welsh-speaking valley is Cwrty Cadno. The tiny village has become an unlikely battleground over the ethics of tree planting. When Ian O'Connor agreed a price for Frongoch Farm, he thought he'd achieved his lifelong dream of owning a farm in his home village to pass on to his three sons. 2 weeks later, however, he was gazumped by a mystery buyer. Well, it turned out, Martin, this is a private equity firm, the Foresight Group, who are buying all this, based in the Shard in London. They're buying all this land up at a much higher price than he was prepared to offer for it, to plant trees, so that when Railtrack have to pay their carbon offset fees, they're going to this private equity firm, and they're basically taking this away from rural farmers. So there you go. It's happening in Wales, just down the road. I'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The land and the rural-urban balance is being managed from afar by private equity firms. The government, no one's been asked whether they want this to happen. Did you know, when you think, you know, buying into this Agenda 2030, did you know that actually it's going to mean that farmers are booted off land? They can't afford to buy land anymore. The Welsh government wants to plant 43,000 hectares of woodland in Wales by 2030, but they're not doing it themselves. These private equity firms, Martin, are doing it for them.
Well, the idea that these private equity firms have got any interest in human welfare is absurd. We need to get rid of capitalism, Tony. And Agenda 30, as you mentioned...
2030, yep.
Yeah. This is the fourth industrial revolution that the World Economic Forum are talking about, is their wet dream of what they would like to see in terms of the future.
There doesn't seem to be any pushback by the elected representatives anyway.
Well, the elected representatives have to win election by elections, and they have to have money to win elections, and therefore they need the money from these people to win the elections and so on. In China, it's a bit of a different setup, as you know.
So I'll put a link up to the article and the excellent piece by Rhys Williams on ITV on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Meanwhile, in the cities, we're getting these 15-minute neighbourhoods, as is happening just down the road in Bath right now, and obviously here in Bristol and other cities very soon.
These 15-minute neighbourhoods, you know, Oxford, Bath, where they want to kind of keep you within 15 minutes. Well, basically, I was looking at this story because I think residents in Bath are in uproar because of this. And it's all linked to making sure that everything's within 15 minutes of where you are. So they're going to limit all the traffic and basically make it more cycle friendly, which obviously London's kind of carnage with cyclists. But one of the things, I was reading the Oxford report on this one, and one of the things they say they're doing is to reduce air pollution for health reasons. Obviously a good tick, but this is by 2040. Now, by 2040, if the government gets its way, and you're talking about it today, I think, on the show of electric cars, well, why do you need to stop cars moving around if they're all electric cars by 2040?
Yeah, right.
Absolutely bonkers. And if you've got everything on your doorstep, obviously that's great, but the local shop's more expensive, so the poorest people are going to be affected by this most, Mike. And again, nobody generally, unless you all work from home, very few people live within 15 minutes of their work. So is the government and these local authorities trying to push us down more work from home in the future? Yeah. That's my big concern on this.
Well, exactly. Also, who gave them the impression that anybody wanted any of this? Because they haven't asked us, have they? I don't know if people in Bath were asked or if people in Oxford were asked. I don't believe so. I don't think anyone was asked in London what they thought about expanding ULEZ when the first congestion charge came in. And then when they did ask them, they said they didn't want it. They did it anyway.
And that's the big issue. I put a tweet out about this the other day, and I was saying that the only way you're going to stop this if people don't want it, it comes back to democracy, isn't it? You vote basically the parties out if the local councillors have voted out. My big concern, though, Mike, is it seems to be the Tory party, the Labour party, the Lib Dems, obviously all those with the biggest money, and the Green party in terms of canvassing and, you know, local elections as well. They all want the same thing, you know, this whole net zero. And that's why the energy prices this year are going through the roof. It's because of this obsession with trying to kind of get rid of all of the kind of the fossil fuels. And that's kind of where we've ended up in this place. And say, who's asking for it? I've never seen any manifesto saying, I know they always got net zero in there, but local areas saying, basically, we want to lock you in your areas or have 15-minute zones. I haven't seen any nonsense.
No.
So that's Jamie Jenkins, Stats Jamie, ex head of some division. I think it was actually health statistics at the National Office of Statistics, Martin, saying, well, you know, what they're doing is they're carving up these towns and saying everyone's got to, you know, be within 15 minutes of everything they want, and they're expecting people to cycle. Well, I don't know if you've been around over the last few weeks in the snow, the rain, the hail and everything. It's not really ideal conditions to be cycling from here, there and everywhere, is it?
Well, the idea that people should live in communities where they don't have to travel outside of the community to get basic services is potentially a viable one. The question is, how is it going to work? And of course, the reality of capitalism is that we still build ring roads. We still build motorways. We still build railways. Things can't all be done on a local level. This is the delusion of Liberal Democrats and Greens and others who go on about what we need is more local democracy. Ultimately, that is not viable because the systems under which which modern society works don't function like that. So it's a lot of green, you know, flim-flam, and the reality is that the sewage system has to be a certain size to function. That's why I'm a socialist rather than a green, Tony. That's a bit of a hint.
Yeah, so he's also, Jamie Jenkins is also talking, is an excellent piece, I'll put this up on our show page too, thisweek.org.uk, trying to sum up some of the statistics behind the various crises from 2022. One of them he focuses on specifically is the problems with the National Health Service over in Wales, saying that they've discovered at one of the health trusts, which of course none of us, and certainly on this programme, approve of this whole idea of converting the health service over to these NHS trusts, which are far more secretive than the previous way of organising the health service used to be. Lo and behold, they've discovered a fraud of £122 million has just disappeared from this trust in Wales.
That's a health board in North Wales. So this was a big story, actually, earlier on in the week, covered up by the BBC and some of the Welsh media. And it basically is a fraud investigation going on. This is the Betsy Cadwaladr Health Board up in North Wales. It's been in special measures and kind of been run by the Welsh government themselves on and off for the last kind of 7 or 8 years. And apparently £122 million is unaccounted for in the books. And the BBC asked the auditors, where's the money gone? And the answer was, we don't know.
Blimey. So that's quite a lot of money to lose, that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I crunched some of the numbers. If you actually count all the numbers, all the nurses in Wales, and you take, say, their average salary, that £122 million would actually pretty much match an inflation pay rise.
Right.
When obviously they're all on strike at the moment because they're not getting an inflation pay rise because they can't afford it. Now, obviously, that's only a one-off £122 million. If you give a 10% pay rise, you've got to pay year after year. But absolutely shocking. And you talk about, you know, Welsh Labour is running the NHS and Keir Starmer might win the next general election. Whichever political party is running this, the beast of the NHS, Mike, it's not going to be any better.
No. I mean, that is the problem. The NHS in itself is just not working. And I don't think it matters who you put in charge of it. I mean, I had a call yesterday from a woman who works as a cleaner inside the NHS in Liverpool. She seemed to think the government ran it. I said, well, they don't, do they? The people who run the NHS are the ones that you should be blaming for running it into the ground. The reason why hospitals don't work, the reason why doctors' surgeries can't cope with the number of patients they've got, is purely and simply down to the people running the organisation, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's not, you call it the National Health Service, where you've got devolved nations running it, so it's not really national, it's four different kind of countries managing. And then you look at all of the different trusts that you have, or health boards, it's basically, Mike, loads and loads of different health kind of systems across the country, all being run slightly differently. And what we end up with them, Mike, since you've got so many different ones across the country, you see the adverts for kind of like diversity managers. Every health board needs to have one. You don't need just one. Everybody needs to have one. And it just adds up, costs an absolute fortune, absolute madness. And the you know, Mike, we've come out of the end of 2022 and go into 2023. You know, the health system is completely broken. It's why we've been seeing excess deaths for the last 30 or so weeks. You know, the ambulance service, all the strikes are kicking in as well. You know, the system couldn't cope before the strikes, and it can't cope now. And I'll be talking to you next year at some point, Mike, saying how broken the NHS is even more.
Yes.
We've got to fix this.
Yes, we certainly have. Seems to be no intention by the Tories to fix it. Certainly no intention by Rishi Sunak to fix it. In fact, the Tories for about 20 or 30 years have been working to destroy the NHS, Martin, and privatise it, haven't they?
Well, there shouldn't be trust. NHS trust should never have been created. They were created by the Tories to create an internal market. Now, what worries me about these chaps talking like this, we've got to fix the NHS. What they mean is we need private equity firms from the US to take over on
hospitals. No, I don't think Jamie's saying anything of the sort. I mean, he's someone who's from public service himself.
Okay. Well, I don't know.
Mike Graham, I think you might be right.
Yes, well, this is what I suspect.
He's from the Daily Express.
Well, exactly. And, of course, this is classic shock doctrine stuff. They underfund the health service for years and years and years. We've got less emergency beds per head in Britain than virtually anybody else in Europe. And that's deliberate, because we're running it at an efficient level, whereas when something comes along that we haven't expected, we've suddenly got no beds.
OK, a final clip from Jamie Jenkins and a final clip before the break is on fuel prices and the wholesale fuel prices, and how come they're not being reflected in the retail world. We've just heard in our housing association, by the way, that our service charge, electricity charge, is going up 400%. Thank you very much. And we're saying, well, hey, we're not paying it.
It's all to do with kind of the future price that people are going to. So you get these day-to-day fluctuations. Mm. To me, I struggle a bit with this one as well, mate. It seems to be some dark art in terms of working out how these wholesale prices link into the gas prices when we actually pay. Remember, the cap that comes in comes from kind of Ofgem. They'll set the new cap coming in. And we know the government are already going to be taking off kind of some of the support. So bills are going to go up even further. But yeah, I think there needs to be more transparency in terms of how that has been affected. But one of the things they're looking to change, Mike, because the big windfall over the last year has been the renewable companies, because they get paid for the energy depending on what the kind of the last unit of what goes into the system is produced. And a lot of that comes from gas. So people who've got these wind farms and solar farms, they're making an absolute fortune this year, because that hasn't cost them any more to produce it. Generally, there might have been a little bit of inflation, but the amount of they're getting for that energy, gone through the roof. So we it all comes back down to, Mike, 40 years of government failure. That's the Tory party, the Labour party, the Lib Dems within the coalition on energy security, and we've got to remember that.
Jamie Jenkins, Stats Jamie's his website, Martin.
Well, I mean, underlying all of this is that we should have a nationalised energy structure. We used to have one. The Russians have still got one. The Norwegians have got a national energy structure.
He's right, though, isn't he? It's a bit of a dark art, the futures market for energy.
Yes, you shouldn't have a futures market in energy. There should be long-term prices set by governments negotiating with other governments.
You know, it's funny, isn't it? Because the Russians like to do that sort of thing. Yes. They like to have these long-term contracts over energy prices.
That's right. And the point about this, that's when governments are dealing with other governments. The privatisation, the problem is that the energy companies are private for-profit companies, and they will basically do whatever they can to maximise the profits for their shareholders. That's what they do. And that's why they were nationalised in the 1940s. And then along came Margaret Thatcher and said, we need to put this all back in the private sector. And then, of course, it doesn't work. And then you say, well, what we need now is blah, blah, blah. The National Health Service, if it had been run as a National Health Service, would be the most efficient way to run it. But of course, once you break it up into trusts, and they've all got to make them, each trust has got to pay its way, and then they all make different contracts with different people. There used to be one buyer. There were monopsony buyers. The National Health Service in Britain would buy PPE or drugs or whatever it was, and they could name their price because they're the only buyer. But when you've got lots of different people buying, then they can, the private
then you're
sector
master
can come
of, in. Master of the Masonic Lodge and Conservative Party councillor in Stroud can get the contract and then sell up and buy a nice new farm because he's made a fortune whilst his PPE sits in a container over in Norfolk somewhere rotting in a field.
Indeed. And of course, as you saw, NHS Test and Trace was a private company, but they put NHS on all of the stuff because it's a trusted brand.
This is the guy that's now running the Royal Mail, chief executive from Test and Trace.
Do you remember years ago, Royal Mail bought in for several million pounds PR people who changed the name of Royal Mail to Consignia.
Oh, yeah.
Which means nothing at all. I mean, what does Consignia do? Who knows? And eventually, of course, they had to come back to calling it Royal Mail because it's a trusted brand. But, of course, the modern Royal Mail is run by sharks. It's not run by the government. The whole thing of Royal Mail was it run by the government. And you can trust it because it is the government.
I think those sharks that are put in charge there are just there to destroy the organisation so that people like DPD and FedEx can just take over with a dead Royal Mail. Anyway, we're going to have some music now, a break. Before we do, Martin, it's the Happy Christmas, Orthodox Christmas. It's Christmas
tomorrow.
Orthodox Christmas Eve today. Yeah. Orthodox Christmas tomorrow. Now, of course, this is the genuine original Christmas. It's a called Epiphany over here, which is when the three kings, so-called three kings, actually, as we said in just before Christmas in the show 2 weeks ago, actually really about three wise men.
Kings of Orient are, heavens which gather so far, feel the fountain more and mountain, following on the star.
Rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face. love is like an atom whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Like a tunnel you can follow to a tunnel of its own, down a hollow to a cavern where the sun has never shone. Like a door that keeps revolving in a half-forgotten dream, or the ripples from a pebble someone tosses in a stream. Like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face, and the world is like an apple whirling silently in space. Like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Keys that jingle in your pocket, words that jangle in your head. Why did summer go so quickly? Was it something that you said? Lovers walk along the shore and leave their footprints in the sand. Was the sound of distant drumming just the fingers of your hand? Pictures hanging in a hallway and the fragments of a song. I'd remember names and faces, but to whom do they belong? When you knew that it was over, you were suddenly aware that the autumn leaves were turning to the colour of her hair. A circle in a spiral, a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever-spinning reel, as the images unwind, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind.
Days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days. I won't forget a single day, believe me. I bless the light that lights on you, believe me. Hello, y'all. Every single day, believe me. Days I remember all my life. Days when you can't see wrong from right. You took my life, but then I knew that very soon you'd leave me. But it's alright, now I'm not frightened of this world, believe me. I wish today could be tomorrow. The night is long, it just brings sorrow. Let it wait.
That's Kirsty MacColl finishing up there, and other pieces of music we heard. One was Noel Harrison, The Windmills of Your Mind, but a lovely song from 1989 winding up there, Kirsty MacColl. with Days. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show, that those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner blaring out and blasting out its nonsense. But nothing like that here on the new Talk Radio .org.uk stream. And also you might be listening on the live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, or you can listen afterwards on the app if it's not convenient. Nice thing about the app is it gives you a little bleep or something, depending on whatever you want, just a little while before the show starts. So on a Friday it will go, hey, they're about to start the show. Available free from all good app stores, not Google, please. And if you go to a link on our show page for Android users, obviously it's on the Apple Store too, but if you're an Android user, you can get hold of a copy of the app from a non-Google app store there. Google actually are pretty nasty. Say, for example, with Telegram, they put out some sort of weird version of Telegram, which isn't the official version, and it does look more censorious on Google Play. So do please try and avoid Google every step of the way. Also, we've got Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. But joining me on the line is John Bosnich, political commentator. John, hi, are you there?
Yes, I am. Pleasure to be here.
John, can you just give us a little brief introduction about your, you know, how you got into doing this sort of political commentary? Because you've been getting involved in politics for a while, haven't you?
Oh, basically all of my life. I was a student leader in high school and in university. I served 3 terms as the student union president of a university in Eastern Canada. I was expelled from university because of politics. And I got my degree. I went to Montreal to go to McGill University, which was one of our better universities in Canada. And I was only there a few more months until I witnessed a case of police brutality in the middle of downtown Montreal. And I testified against the police. And to make a very long story short, it ended up in the first condemnation to prison time for police in the history of Montreal. That was 450 years. And so I had to leave Canada. There was no safe way to stay in Canada. The police union said they could not guarantee my safety. I left for Asia. In Asia, I met two gentlemen who had been working in Japan, and they introduced me to Japan. I went to Japan. I joined the Japanese National World Service of Radio Japan World Service in English, and I was working there and gradually became aware of more and more about how completely corrupt and how criminal this world is run. And I happened to be there at the time when Bobby Fischer was arrested for playing chess in the former Yugoslavia. My father was from Yugoslavia, and at that time I had made my way up to being an advisor to the Prime Minister's office in Japan. I resigned. I sued the Prime Minister. I ended up suing George Bush and the U.S. government in grand jury in Washington. We defeated them both, and we got Bobby Fischer out of jail in Japan and found him asylum in Iceland. So a gradual trip until the peak of criminality, that's what I call it.
So you're now in Belgrade, am I right?
That's right. I've moved to Belgrade. I've left Canada. I live in Belgrade full time now. And here I'm spending most of my time opposing the efforts to suck Serbia into NATO and into the EU.
Well, I just love the way you use this word Yugoslavia quite a lot, don't you? And of course, it was actually quite an important country under Tito. Can you just give us, in a nutshell, what happened? Because he was keeping things together. In fact, he even faced down Stalin, didn't he, after the Second World War?
Well, it's more complex than that. Yugoslavia was a very important country even before Tito took it over. Tito came into power in 1944, at the end of 1944. But before that, it was a kingdom, and that kingdom was formed just after World War I by the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, who felt that for safety's sake and for unity of a Slavic nation, it was much safer to live together in one country. Yugo just means south. So it was the country or the kingdom of the South Slavs. Up until World War II, the Communist Party that Tito led had been opposed to Yugoslavia, saying it was a prison for nationalities. But when it came to taking power, they found it quite convenient to take power over the entire country. The backstory on Tito is that Tito, and this might surprise some of your listeners, but Tito, a communist, and Pavelić, the Ustasha fascist dictator of World War II Croatia, were both on the British secret payroll from 1925. Both of them that were there because it was British government policy to destroy Yugoslavia, to make Yugoslavia weak, because both the Royal Yugoslavia and the later Yugoslavia were both pro-Russian. And England saw Russia as the enemy, being the main land power controlling most of Asia and much of Europe. So England supported the putting into power of Josip Broz Tito, and Tito entered into power with English support, and when it came time, England pulled Tito out. So Tito in 1948 was not alone against Russia, but he had English support. England has been a major player against the interests of the people in this region since World War One until today.
Amazing. Anyway, we'll be talking a bit about NATO's destruction of Yugoslavia in a minute, but coming right up to today, I'm sure you've got some views yourself on the situation over in Ukraine. We've had the Russian President Vladimir Putin saying that he wants to have a truce there, actually over the Orthodox Christmas, haven't we?
Yes, we do. And this is not a new thing for President Putin. President Putin has presided over the transformation of the Soviet Union into a multi-party Russian Federation. And part of his revival of the Russian state has involved the building up of the Russian Orthodox Church and the reintroduction of Russian religious customs. So this offer of a truce is not a first offer of this type. It has been the policy of President Putin since coming to power, and we're already into the second decade of his time.
Well, you're calling it a multi-party state, but actually United Russia seems to be almost like a unipolar state.
Well, we've got the dominant party. You know, I come from Canada, where we had one prime minister who stayed in power for 37 years. So that was Mackenzie King, and he was in power from World War II all the way into the 1950s, late 50s, and we had from pre-World War II into the late 1950s. So the fact that a country might have a dominant party, which in Canada's case was the Liberal Party and still is the Liberal Party, does not necessarily mean that it's a mono-party state. There are multi-parties, and there are multiple points of view. And the same was the case here in Yugoslavia. I can tell you that in the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia that was led at the end by Slobodan Milosevic, you had far, far more freedom of speech than I ever enjoyed in Canada. I'm telling you, there were ultra-right, ultra-left, and every single thing in between in the former Yugoslavia. And that did not serve the purposes of NATO, which basically wants a liberal capitalist system which is built on a military-industrial complex. The Western model of economy now is a military-industrial complex which feeds on human blood, unfortunately.
Well, and one of the things that announced today is the United States is going to be sending the Bradley fighting vehicles in a $3 billion arms package to Ukraine. We've heard also about the HIMARS rockets being used to strike targets far within Russia, but from Ukraine. Of course, this is US helping with the targeting. Obviously, the Ukrainians can't see that far into Russia. The US satellites.
It's not just that the US is helping with the targeting. Today, it was admitted that the United States is actually operating the HIMARS. The Ukrainians have not yet been trained how to operate the HIMARS. So every HIMAR that's being used in Ukraine is being used by U.S. soldiers.
So the actual U.S. soldiers are on the ground in Ukraine killing Russians, fighting Russia. So, I mean, this isn't actually, as far as I know, officially a war between NATO and Russia, but it does seem to be on the ground. That's what's going on.
Well, it's a proxy war in which the primary victims are the Ukrainian people, because the United States saw an opportunity to advance its border further to the east in its what Hitler and the Kaisers called Drang nach Osten, which means the drive to the east. And this has been the basic modus operandi of the NATO alliance and of the Western allies even before NATO was created. They would like to actually run the entire world. They used to say that they were opposed to communism and they were protecting the world from communism. But now that communism is gone in Russia and Russia has a democratic system in which you can run for different parties and you can publish different points of view, what we're seeing is that it is not an anti-communist movement, but it is an actual disguised effort to run the world centrally from the United States with the advice and guidance of London.
Well, of course. I noticed also that the British-run Spytek firm has been fueling the Ukraine proxy war, putting civilians at risk. That is according to Kit Clarenberg in the Grey Zone today. So leaked files reveal that the Anomaly 6 spy firm is providing intelligence to the British military through a cutout involved in the Kerch bridge bombing and other acts of dangerous sabotage in the Ukraine conflict. On the 6th of December, the Grey Zone revealed how British military and intelligence agencies were deploying technology created by a private intelligence firm, Anomaly 6, to illegally spy on citizens across the globe. The company's technology effectively transforms every individual on Earth into a potential target for surveillance and asset recruitment by monitoring the movements of their smartphone. Anomaly 6 embeds tracking software in popular applications and slices through layers of theoretically anonymous data to uncover a wealth of sensitive information about a device's owner. So certainly, you know, the Grey Zone quite nicely there have revealed the British involvement too. But the United States has dismissed Putin's Christmas truce offer as a cynical ploy. Well, it's not an offer. It's been a ceasefire. As far as I know, the Russians are simply not firing back at the moment. I'm not sure quite what's going on over there. But also, at the same time, we've had the Turkish President Erdogan, I'm sure this has been coordinated with the Russians, saying, look, let's mediate a lasting peace in Ukraine. What do you think Erdogan's offer is going to be taken up by Zelensky?
Absolutely not, because Zelensky doesn't have the ability to take up or reject any offer. Zelensky himself is nothing more than a puppet. His nation have been turned into cannon fodder. Zelensky is a puppet, and the decisions are being made in London and in Washington. And given the wealth of the United States and the size of their military, they actually give the final calls, but they're, sorry to say, they're not well enough educated to know the things they need to know on the field. And so they use British and especially English experts to advise them what to do. And then they are basically the brawn of the empire. These Bradley fighting vehicles will have no effective function in Ukraine except to be destroyed. And that's why they're being sent there. And I want to sort of play with the words we're using here. You said that the United States is sending $3 billion to Ukraine. Actually, what's happening is the United States is taking $3 billion from Ukraine. Every time the United States gives weapons to Ukraine, those weapons are owed back by Ukraine. And that's why the United States and England cannot pull out of this war without losing face and certainly losing power internationally on this planet. They have now given, they call it given, over $75 $1 billion in weapons. What is actually happening is they are taking the weapons, which they pay their own military-industrial complex to produce, and they indebt the people of Ukraine. The only way the United States and England will ever get their money back is by colonizing Ukraine and taking its natural resources to pay back these debts.
That's a quite That's a good financial incentive to take back that land, I suppose. Martin?
Hi there. I'm broadly in agreement with everything you've said. I used to be an aid worker in the war in the 1990s. I used to fly out from London for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development. And I had to, you know, obviously I was trying to understand what was going on at the time. And, you know, with hindsight, you can see the manipulations that were going on by NATO. It wasn't so clear at the time as it is now. And of course, you can see that the Ukraine is another manipulation of a similar kind, but with a much more dangerous agenda behind it, because it, you know, there's so much more at stake. The role of the British Special Forces and Intelligence Service is particularly pernicious, because I think they were involved in the assassination of Zakhachenko, who was the elected Prime Minister of the Donetsk Republic, who was killed in a car bomb attack, as were Givi and Motorola, who were paramilitary leaders. This is the kind of thing that British Special Forces specialise in. And the Russians have already said that, as far as they can see, the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was carried out by the British Special Boat Squadron. Now, most people in Britain are completely unaware of this, and I don't suppose that the Russians are going to directly retaliate against Britain for this, because that's not the way they operate.
Well, I mean, we try and
but it's a pretty vicious mess, isn't it?
We try and do a balanced programme here, at least I definitely try to, and so we're going to try and put the views. It's not easy to find King Charles talking about Ukraine much, although it's quite clear that he doesn't approve of Putin. He's accused him in the past, and actually I did an article for RT years ago saying that Prince Charles, as he was at the time, strikes another blow for the British Republic, as he accused Putin of being a Nazi. That was way back about 8, 10, maybe 9 years ago. But let's have a listen to a much more recent view from Putin, and we'll hear afterwards from King Charles in his New Year's Christmas address that he's done now he's taken over from the Queen. So first of all, Putin on one side.
Dear friends, Russia has been living under sanctions since the events in Crimea in 2014. Yet this year, an all-out sanction war has been declared against us. The masterminds behind it expected our industrial, financial, and transportation sectors to collapse. This didn't happen. Together, we have built an adequate backup. Everything we have done and continue to do is aimed at achieving sovereignty in the critical area, our economy. Our struggle for ourselves, for our interests and future, is inspiring for other nations as they aspire to forge an equitable and multipolar world. It is of great importance that in the outgoing year our nation especially valued mercy, solidarity, and its readiness to help. Increasingly more people feel they need to assist each other. They join their efforts on their own initiative, without any instructions. Thank you for your tenderness, responsibility, and kindness, for joining the common cause despite differences in age and prosperity, for organizing warehouses and transportation of supplies to our soldiers in the war zone and residents of war-torn towns and villages, for sending children from our new regions on holidays.
Well, he's talking there about some of the things that are going on behind the scenes, really, in the war. And that was President Vladimir Putin. I'll put the full version of his speech up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk if you'd like to hear it. Of course, very little of it got heard anywhere in the Western media. Joined by John Bosnich from Belgrade. John, what do you make of Putin's speech there? He did it particularly with all these soldiers standing behind him. Various soldiers stood behind him, almost like backing him up, like, you know, this is the guy we support. So what do you make of his pitch, I suppose, to the Russian people? Very little of it heard, of course, here in the West.
Well, first of all, you're right that the messages coming from President Putin are very seldom heard clearly in the West. The Putin interviews that were held years ago was basically the first time anybody heard anything from Putin that was not censored or completely twisted out of shape. President Putin obviously is in the middle of an extended war here. And when I say extended, I'm not talking about a war that started in February, but we're talking about a war that NATO, namely England and America, and I say England because basically the decisions are made in London. They're not being made in Scotland or in Northern Ireland. We've got a situation where these two nuclear powers decided that they had a viable chance of destabilizing Russia by creating this war in Ukraine. The president of Russia had sat by without directly intervening from 2014 when America and England together staged a coup and overthrew the elected president, the duly democratically elected president of Ukraine, in order to provoke this conflict.
But surely that, hang on, surely that yes. coup was actually managed by people like Viktor Pinchuk and Yatsenyuk. These are Ukrainians.
Oh, well, these are Ukrainians on the payroll. There's a $5 billion budget that was explicitly discussed by Victoria Nuland, who was there on the scene on behalf of the U.S. State Department. And, you know, I have some background in all of this. My father, being an exile from Eastern Europe, made his way out of then communist Yugoslavia to Italy and from Italy to Switzerland. In Switzerland, he got a scholarship and came to Canada. Well, his roommate at McGill University was none other than Zbigniew Brzezinski. Now, that means that I have personal knowledge through my father and through speaking with Zbigniew while he was still alive about trying to stop the war in Yugoslavia. When you have access to somebody like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who left Canada after studying in Montreal and explicitly said, the money is down in the States, quote unquote, and went to the United States, ingratiated himself with the Democratic Party, and moved himself up the ladder, then you've got direct access to the way these things are done. And coincidentally, my father was a colleague of Henry Kissinger. So when I worked in Japan for the Japanese Prime Minister's office, I had access to the chief international policymakers for both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And the point is that inside the United States, these two parties have somewhat different faces. But outside the United States, they are both the party of
empire. Yeah, well, it's interesting you bring up Kissinger. He's getting his knuckles wrapped, isn't he, for saying, oh, we, you know, maybe that Zelensky is going to have to cede this territory. There should be a ceasefire. He's kind of agreeing with Erdogan and Putin.
Well, Kissinger has historically been slightly more honest or less of a liar than Brzezinski was. These players, as they get up in their years, really haven't got anything to lose by telling the truth. And Kissinger is reporting the fact that this war is lost for NATO. This war is lost for America.
But I mean, the irony here is that surely Kissinger is one of the policymakers that was behind starting it in the first place. I'm reminded of the US dollar and the sign on the back with this giant eagle on the back with one hand holding the arrows and the other one hand holding the olive branch of peace.
Well, the olive branch is only delivered after you kill everybody who could resist you. I mean, the United States is not just an economy based on the military-industrial complex, but its entire foreign policy is based on having the biggest fleet, the most aircraft, the most deadly weapons, the most widely deployed military, and the most foreign military bases in human history. That's what their system is. And they have an internal total media control system that keeps somebody like Noam Chomsky from getting on any media in the United States for decades. Noam Chomsky had to travel to Canada or be interviewed by radio or by telephone for radio stations in Canada and then to be broadcast back into the United States. You've got a situation here where you had two dictatorships, the Soviet Union and the United States, one which was exposed as being a single-party system by the Western media, and the other which is clothed in the clothing of democracy, but has turned out to be an even more potent, more deadly, and more aggressive dictatorship than the Soviet Union ever could have been.
Well, it's time now to hear from the one of the bosses on the opposite side from Putin, that is to say King Charles. He's taken a very key role, of course, in the World Economic Forum, in the Agenda 2030, in the Fourth Industrial Revolution, all these kinds of things. And now, I don't know quite how he's going to manage to be apolitical as king, as he's supposed to be. I suppose it's quite impossible, but he's taken over from the Queen. Before we hear this little clip, and I'll put the full version up on our show page, it's about the same length, a minute and a half, as we heard from Putin a minute ago. Just to say that, I mean, listening to it, I just felt there was something horrifying about the way, I mean, at least the Queen's broadcasts came across as sincere. To me, this is incredibly wooden. I just don't trust the guy at all. But anyway, let's give him a chance. Let's see what you think.
At this time of great anxiety and hardship, be it for those around the world facing conflict, famine, or natural disaster, or for those at home finding ways to pay their bills and keep their families fed and warm, we see it in the humanity of people throughout our nations and the Commonwealth who so readily respond to the plight of others. I particularly want to pay tribute to all those wonderfully kind people who so generously give food or donations, or that most precious commodity of all, their time, to support those around them in greatest need. Together with the many charitable organizations which do such extraordinary work in the most difficult circumstances, our churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, and gurdwaras have once again united in feeding the hungry, providing love and support throughout the year. Such heartfelt solidarity is the most inspiring expression of loving our neighbour as ourselves. The Prince and Princess of Wales recently visited Wales, shining a light on practical examples of this community spirit.
Well, that's King Charles there giving a little excerpt from his Christmas message. I don't know quite what the approval rating was for that here in the UK, the number of people watching. I suppose a lot of people are curious to see how's he going to do. But anyway, what do you make of the opposition to Putin generally? I mean, I'm not asking you specifically to focus on King Charles, because he's obviously part of it, having labelled Putin, he's saying basically Putin is the new Hitler.
First of all, that's absurd on the face. I mean, there is no similarity whatsoever between Vladimir Putin and Adolf Hitler, except to say that both of them are heads of state. I want to jump back a little bit as a born Canadian. I think that King Charles's effort to replicate his mother's role is not going to wash. When I listen to him speak, I can literally see the speechwriters who wrote the speech that he is reading. It is not coming from him. He is one of the richest men in the world, and he does not show the kind of perfected acting that Her Majesty showed during her reign. I think that we may be looking at the last King of England in the form of King Charles. I think that the time is up for monarchs who are 100 millionaires and billionaires to tell people what the community spirit is. I think that the very fact that there's anyone, and I mean anyone, in Great Britain who doesn't have enough to eat is the more important question. How is it that a rich country cannot feed every person, and how is it that they have to rely upon charity?
Well, that's a terrific question.
The government system doesn't work.
Maybe Martin can address that in a minute, but I mean, that's a fantastic question. It's like I'm listening to him talking about people not being able to pay their bills, not being able to feed their kids, not being able to keep warm. Butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. This is one of the, like you say, one of the richest men in the world. He's managed to collect all the wealth from his mother without having to pay a penny of tax on it whatsoever, and it's you know, and yet he's saying, oh, I feel for you, you know, you can't pay your bills. Well, actually, maybe he should say, if you can't pay your bills, send me a little letter, I'll pay them for you.
exactly, well done. I mean, the fact is here that it's an anachronism to have a king in this day and age, first of all. And second of all, as somebody who grew up and was raised and educated in Canada, I can tell you that Canada is another example of a country, one of the absolutely richest countries in the world per capita. And Canada is now contributing soldiers and weapons to the war, far more to the war in Ukraine, which is initiated by the West, than it's doing to help its own poor people in Canada. This is the height of hypocrisy. It is an example of why this world needs to change. And the battle that's taking place in Ukraine will hopefully put an end to the war-based Western economy.
Yeah, it's very awkward for King Charles because he's made these comments about Putin as the new, you know, Hitler. You know, he's supposed to be in charge of the diplomatic service as well as many other things. Of course, it's not a very diplomatic comment to have made. Of course, his mother probably cringed when he said that and thought, well, good God, you know, you shouldn't be saying idiotic things like this, boy. So, Martin, what do you make of what we've been hearing here? It'd be nice to hear your take, because in the background to all of this, we've got all this Meghan Markle and Prince Harry stuff coming out over the last few days. It seems as that Harry and Charles together could actually bring the British monarchy to an end.
Well, to be honest with you, as you know, Tony, I'm not that interested in the British monarchy. The war in the Ukraine is more important than the future of the British monarchy. What I'd be interested to hear the views of our guest here about two things. One is the role of Chrystia Freeland as the foreign minister of Canada, because she has actually got Ukrainian background. Her grandfather was a Banderite who came to Canada, and many of them did. They were taken to Canada.
A Nazi. Let's just make it clear. A Nazi. Yeah, well, a real Nazi.
Yeah. The other thing I'd like to mention before I stop is the comments by Angela Merkel and Hollande, who were the guarantors of the Minsk agreements in 2015. And Angela Merkel a couple of days ago said, well, the Minsk agreements were just a trick, really, so that we weren't negotiating in good faith with the separatists in the Donbass, and we've allowed the Ukrainians to build up their forces so that we could have a war. And she said, and there was always going to be a war because Russia was not pacified. Those were her exact words. Russia has not been pacified.
Anyway, yeah, okay. So, over to you, John.
Yeah.
Well, pacified in those terms means neutralized, destroyed. And that has been the aim of England in particular, and of America since World War II, to destroy Russia. Because Russia actually is a very powerful, large country with a great territorial mass and one of the richest countries in the world by resources. The resources of Russia have not even begun to be tapped.
Well, one of the things that Putin also talks about in his speech is saying, well, we've been preparing actually quite a long time now to be entirely self-sufficient as a nation. So in a way, what's happened is these efforts of the West over decades, you're just describing, John, have been a complete failure. They've hit a brick wall now.
They've been more than a failure. What they've done, I mean, they've been actually good for the Russian people, but they've been more than a failure for the West, because by instituting the sanctions, the West actually revealed its teeth. And it showed the Russian people, and not just the Russian people, it showed the Chinese people, the Indian people, and other nations all around the world, the Serbian people, it showed them that these were wolves in sheep's clothing. We know what we're up against now. And you know, I may not sound like your typical passive, neutral, peace-loving Canadian, and I'm not anymore, because I've been on the front line of wars here. I spent 6 years on the front line of NATO's war on the Yugoslav peoples, all of them. I spent the time seeing who they attacked, why they attacked them, who they bribed, who they used against each other, and I'm revolted by it. I'm disgusted by it. And I've said to myself, you know, John, you could have just stayed in Japan and made whopping amounts of money, or you could try to make the world a better place for your children. And the second is far, far more important than the first.
One of the fascinating little outbursts this week, you suppose you could call it, on the BBC. In fact, it was on Sunday morning, the first day of the new year here, on what's called Broadcasting House on BBC Radio 4, used to be called the Home Service, by a guy called Paddy O'Connell, was pride of place in that programme on Sunday mornings given to a guy called Sir Geoffrey Nice. Now, do you want to say something about his role with the trial of Slobodan Milosevic and who Milosevic was, please, John?
Well, I knew Slobodan Milosevic personally. I helped to organize his defense at The Hague. And I want to tell you how much of an unusual situation this was. My grandfather was the commander of the Royal Guard of his cousin, King Alexander of the Kingdom of Yugoslavia. My family was exiled from Yugoslavia for 60 years for being monarchists. I came here from Japan when the Yugoslav communist government invited me to come here as a journalist. I had been working already in Japan for some 15 years as a journalist, and they invited me to come here. I met Slobodan Milosevic. I told him my family background, and that didn't faze him in the least. And I gradually learned that not only was Slobodan Milosevic a former communist who introduced the multi-party democratic system here in Yugoslavia, but he was also the man who was defending the independence of these people against the globalist New World Order. And so I helped to organize his defense. I met him. I interviewed him. I worked with his foreign minister, and we actually fought in the media for years. And I'm fully convinced that he was murdered in The Hague, that he did not die of natural causes. I have no proof. I do know that he was given the wrong medicine, the reverse medicine of what he was supposed to be receiving. And I do know that there was no effort to let independent doctors see President Milosevic. So here you have the son of the commander of the Royal Guard of the former Kingdom of Yugoslavia supporting the ex-communist so-called butcher of the Balkans, which he absolutely was not, and seeing two sides of the coin and realizing that I was brought up in a criminal, aggressive, war-based economy, and I've moved to a place which was the victim of that world war system, a permanent war of acquisition, theft of resources, brainwashing of the public, and the total control, not of just what you hear and see and read, but of what you think.
Well, Martin,
because the minute you express a divergent view, your future is over.
Well, that's what we were talking about with Lord Mandelson, best buddies with Nathan Rothschild earlier on in the Labour Party, and no one questioning Keir Starmer in the Labour Party anymore. But anyway, look, Milosevic was on trial, Martin, in 2005, 2006 at The Hague for war crimes in the International Criminal Court, but died, just happened to die. It does suggest to me that perhaps he had a pretty good defence.
Well, I think that John will correct me if I'm wrong here, that in the end they couldn't pin anything on him. I mean, exactly. he was just the political leadership of a country that had been targeted by NATO, and that was all there was to it, really. I remember when I used to go over to Yugoslavia. I also went to Bulgaria at one stage. I was in my 30s, and I spoke at the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences about economics. And they liked what I'd said, and I were in the bar afterwards. This guy came up to me and said, well, I used to be the Bulgarian foreign minister. I think it was probably in the Socialist Party, which was the former Communist Party in Bulgaria. And he said to me, well, you do realise that the Americans have created this war in Yugoslavia, don't you? And I was a bit naive in those days. I said, well, they've made loads of mistakes. They just blunder around smashing into things. They're incompetent. They're brutal. But I don't think they've done it deliberately. But of course, I was younger then. I'm older now. It's quite clear that they did do it deliberately, and they've deliberately created the war in the Ukraine. I'm just checking whether you know, for example, John, that the massacre in the Maidan Square in 2014 was carried out by a NATO death squad. We know that. Absolutely. Know that because there was a court case in Kiev where the Berkut riot police were acquitted. Because the people who had actually carried out the massacre testified from Georgia that they were the snipers who'd shot down both police officers and demonstrators. A tactic, incidentally, which was also used in Syria and in Venezuela. The people running the United States of America are every bit as vicious as the people running Nazi Germany. They just smell a bit, you know, their PR is better.
John?
Well, I agree completely. I can tell you that when I first arrived here in the Balkans, I was sent by Radio Television Japan. I also worked for the Daily Yomiuri, which was the English branch of the then largest newspaper in the world. I worked for the American Chamber of Commerce in Japan, if you can imagine that, and for the Foreign Correspondents Club of Japan. So I was representing basically the government, the foreign media, the state media, and the independent private media of Japan. And they sent me over here. And as soon as I got back, I was invited by the Prime Minister's office to come and be debriefed. I debriefed the Japanese Prime Minister's office. And from that moment forward, Japan was not going to be supporting the war in the former Yugoslavia because they had come to the very same conclusion that I have and that you have come to about Ukraine. They provoke these wars. These wars are planned years in advance. The planning for the breakup of Yugoslavia was put down on paper in the mid-1970s. In the mid-1970s, when the Winter Olympics were held in Sarajevo, that was the opportunity to infiltrate the region and put agents into the zone, and that was the time to start paying the secret agents on the ground. And they're still paying him here. They are working through Masonic organizations. They're working through aid organizations. They're working through the Red Cross. We had the Red Cross transporting weapons hidden in their trucks. We had reporters. We had reporters from England. We had reporters from America who were literally copying their stories one from the other and getting the original texts from the U.S. State Department. I sat in the room where the journalists worked together and put this whole story together. Tim Judah was one of them. I watched him literally copy the reports from a U.S. reporter and just circulate them as if they were English media reports. No visit to the front. Christian Amanpour was reporting from Sarajevo about events 2 hours outside of Sarajevo. I went to the place about which she had reported in the morning. None of it was true. Not a single word. And this is the power of total media control. If you have total media control through the mass media, you can trick the public into anything.
And it's just interesting. It's, I mean, we talked about in our last show a fortnight ago about the Bilderberg conference, which we've announced is going to be in Lisbon on the 17th to the 20th of May this year. And the hotels, if you want, I'll put a link up. Of course, I will put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the details of which hotel it's going to be in, and maybe even in a few weeks' time, some recommended hotels for people that want to go and report on the Bilderberg conference and maybe take pictures of the people as they go in and out, depending on how much access we have to them. Do you want us to say quickly, John, anything about the Bilderbergers? Because I've done quite a lot of work on these people. They do certainly seem to be the political arm of NATO and obviously involved very much with the Yugoslav conflict, as they were at the time. Many of the people who were going to the Bilderberg conferences, such as George Robertson, who was the Secretary General of NATO at the time, and their significance, because one of the things I realized after a little while digging into it, well, this is really a Nazi organization. Prince Bernhard, who was a SS officer and a traitor of Holland during the Second World War. I've done a book about it called The Traitors of Arnhem, basically making sure that the British lost that battle. One of the people doing it, including Lord Carrington, who also then became a NATO Secretary General, and others. But the role of the Bilderbergers is surely, you know, basically, this is the military being in charge and the NATO saying, we're going to make sure that only our people get into politics anywhere in the NATO countries.
Absolutely. I know there are enough coincidences in this one discussion to write a little article about. I was the person writing the speeches for the Japanese delegation to the Bilderbergers. Now, what that means is I was on the inside of the machine looking out. And what we were supposed to be saying from Japan was sent to us via the U.S. Embassy. The U.S. Embassy would then send it to the Foreign Ministry of Japan and dictate the Foreign Ministry policy of Japan. Inside Japan, there was a struggle between the U.S.-controlled Japanese Foreign Ministry and the Japanese Prime Minister's office, where actual Japanese nationalists were trying to slowly get back in control of their own country. So the Bilderbergers is merely the swapping of documents that have been pre-written, pre-prepared. The meeting is a sort of greet and meet, shake hands, look each other in the eyes. But the Bilderbergers itself is the final stage of the solidification of policy that's been built up over 2 or 3 years in advance. And the same for the Trilateral Commission. The Trilateral Commission is another one of these international bodies that just is holding meetings for the players to shake each other's hands, look each other in the eye, and finalize the next war, the next theft, the next bombing, or the next super deception of the public.
Hey, John, you know, you're talking about, it sounds to me like you're talking about actually all this is scripted. It's like in fact, we had Andrew Bridgen on a fortnight ago, the Tory MP in the House of Commons, saying that much of what the government spokespeople were saying during COVID in front of their little plinths, telling everyone to lock down, etc., was like a play.
It was a play, and it was scripted in advance, and not just COVID. Referendums, political campaigns, both parties are scripted. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party, until Donald Trump showed up. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party were scripted by the same people. I know personally the scriptwriter and the speechwriter for George Bush the Younger. I was the scriptwriter and the speechwriter for the Japanese Prime Minister's office. We spoke to each other. The two scriptwriters spoke to each other to compare notes. This is the way the thing is done. All of this international politics is nothing more than theater for the masses.
Well, look, the International Criminal Court is getting a little bit agitated after this chap we spoke about earlier called Sir Geoffrey Nice, who was involved in the Milosevic trial all those years ago in 2005, 2006. He was speaking on this program, as I said, and the very first day of the new year on the BBC with Paddy O'Connell. And let's have a listen now to his opening remarks about how he believes Vladimir Putin should also go to The Hague, to the International Criminal Court, for crimes against humanity.
It's 2023. Happy New Year. At 9 o'clock, this is BH Broadcasting House. I'm Paddy O'Connell. Hello. President Putin should be indicted for war crimes now, according to the man who was lead prosecutor of Slobodan Milosevic. The former president of Serbia was arrested in 2001 and held at the UN War Crimes Tribunal for genocide and other war crimes. Sir Geoffrey Nice joined the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and led the case against him. He says the latest missile strikes against civilians in Ukraine mean an indictment of Vladimir Putin is overdue and he should be tried in his absence.
It couldn't be clearer. The strangest thing is that politicians and lawyers don't seem to be speaking out, saying it for what it is. It is crimes against humanity because civilian targets should never be bombed or otherwise attacked. And there can be no doubt about the chain of command leading directly to Putin. These are his soldiers. And as a minimum, he knows from the television what we all do about what's happening. Not only is it reasonably to be expected that they're acting in accordance with his instructions and commands, but he has said nothing since February to indicate that they're not doing that. He's not brought them back to be tried for what are obvious crimes. That's because he is in charge, they're doing what he wants, and he's a guilty man. Of course, at any trial, he would have to go through the process of a trial, and if he had a defence, he would have to be properly heard. But it's surprising to me that people of authority who know these things aren't spelling this out much more freely and openly for what it really is.
And is there a chance that that's because prosecution could be waived in some sort of deal for peace? Does it feel to you like Western resolve is weakening here?
I'm not sufficiently plugged into politics to know whether it's resolved, but from what I hear, there's absolutely no guarantee of it sticking together and holding. Now, here, I think, is an interesting possibility when you look at the International Criminal Court, which has jurisdiction over Ukraine, and has still not made a pronouncement about Putin's responsibility for this crime. There are other crimes to be considered, but this crime is a straightforward one. And that one's bound to ask the question, is the prosecutor's reluctance, that's Karim Khan's reluctance, to make a statement or to issue an indictment, is it because he thinks or is made to think that there could be political advantage in not indicting Putin, the political advantage being settlement? However, if that's the case, and it quite possibly is the case, is the following possibility that there will be a settlement agreement drafted by someone or other, not by the Ukrainians, which will have a clause in it saying Putin will not be tried. That's an appalling prospect, and it will be a complete denial of justice to the people of Ukraine. So that's the sort of thing we have to look to.
So that's Sir Geoffrey Nice speaking on the BBC a few days ago, John.
The height of absurdity. The height of absurdity. I mean, all of the concepts of Western justice are based on innocent unless proven guilty by a fair tribunal of one's peers. Here's Geoffrey Nice talking about the man as being guilty before he's even been indicted. And that's what we had here in the Balkans through the entire period. They called people indicted war criminal. Never tried, never brought to court, never found guilty. They just called him a war criminal of a particular flavor called the indicted war criminal. Geoffrey Nice is nothing short of a war proponent, a out-and-out liar about the meaning and understanding of the meaning of justice, and is actually one of the weapons, a personal human weapon of the military-industrial complex, because the average human being does believe in fairness. The average human being does believe in a fair trial. The average human being believes in peace. And to get the average human being to look the other way, they have to turn the enemy into the devil. And that's the reason for the demonization of Slobodan Milosevic. That's the reason for the demonization of Ratko Mladic. That's the reason for the demonization of everybody else who's been targeted, Assad in Syria. That is the reason behind all of this. Gaddafi, all of these people first have to be demonized, dehumanized by people like Jeffrey Nice, and what a terrible name for such an evil person. And then they sell this to the public, and the public, who barely has enough time to put food on their table, as King Charles said, simply can't afford to investigate the lies that are fed to them 24/7 all year round. That's the world we live in.
So Jeffrey Nice goes on to talk about how he thinks that the International Criminal Court should indict Putin very soon. I seem to also remember, John, that actually one of the people who the International Criminal Court were trying actually committed suicide, didn't he, by taking poison whilst he was actually on camera in one of the trials.
That's correct. Because there was, and this was a Croatian militia leader, a general, I believe, later, who actually killed himself rather than submit to the sentence imposed upon him. I believe he was given 40 years sentence. These people have to start by explaining who was guilty for Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and what happened to those people, and why they, who killed more civilians intentionally than any of these other wars, why those people are celebrated as heroes. We live in a world where the monologue from the state, from the military-industrial state, is so loud that the average person can't even hear themselves think.
Yeah, the Croatian war criminal who died back in 2017 after taking poison himself, swallowing poison in court. His name was Slobodan Prajak, and he deliberately, and in fact he said, "I'm swallowing poison now because I don't recognise the court and I don't this is not very good for the credibility of the International Criminal Court, this kind of thing, where people are prepared to kill themselves rather than submit to their in fact, when Julian Assange comes to mind, and we'll have a little piece about that before we finish. But anyway, the next instalment from Sir Jeffrey Nice, I'm sure everyone's looking forward to it, particularly you, John, is where he talks about getting an indictment as soon as possible of Putin.
Our programme today is looking at predictions for 2023. There could be an early indictment by the International Criminal Court. There's no reason why there couldn't be one as early as the end of January.
No, it could be tomorrow morning, so far as I'm concerned. And I had heard from another source that something is expected soon.
Oh, really? And then I wonder if you can tell me if, in your judgment, there should be as much energy devoted to individual on-the-ground chain of command, or should the Ukrainians in particular focus on pushing for a trial of the top leadership all the way to the Kremlin?
I think it would be impertinent of me to give advice to the Ukrainians in that format. However, I can say this. I think there's a risk when people bundle together all war crimes trials. Trials of leadership are very different from trials of foot soldiers. Trials of leadership should happen as soon as possible and be as clear as possible, and should allocate moral responsibility at the earliest possible moment in a way that can't be later challenged or changed. That's what happened, as a matter of interest, at the Nuremberg leadership trial, which was all done and dusted in a year and fixed for all time the moral responsibility of the Nazis. As the trial of individual soldiers, at the moment they've got thousands and many thousands of possible cases that could give rise to trials of individual Russian soldiers. The Ukrainians are saying they're going to try every one of those cases, and at the moment we must support them. But let's perhaps take a step back and look forward. In 10, 20 years' time, assuming that the war has come to a conclusion in Ukraine's favour, will it still be right to be seeking out every single soldier from every part of the Russian Federation that has been brought in to engage in this war? I think different considerations might apply then. Advice I would give is that we must support the Ukrainians in everything that they want to do, but that trying Putin is, in my view, the most important thing.
And would that be in The Hague or in Ukraine?
In Ukraine. First of all, there's no established court in The Hague apart from the International Criminal Court that could try him. They've been slow in getting off the blocks, as we perhaps just discussed. These are the gravest possible crimes committed on Ukraine's territory. And one of the privileges and duties of sovereignty of a state is to deal with crimes committed on your own territory.
Mm.
And what's what should be done by Ukrainians and in their own language.
So, second of our three clips from Sir Geoffrey Nice, John.
Well, more of the same. Nothing short of a travesty of justice. You might have heard of the book by John Loughlin about the trial of Slobodan Milosevic. It's called Travesty. That's a book you should take a look at. That talks about how every single fundamental rule of justice was violated by that tribunal. Look at the ICC, the so-called, and it has to be called the so-called International Criminal Court, because the biggest military-industrial power on the planet has exempted itself from the ICC. The United States does not recognize the ICC. So what kind of a court is it that the biggest offender with the most military bases outside of its territory declares itself exempt from justice? That means that the ICC is nothing more than a vehicle for the American empire. It exempted itself from it. We've got, you know, I have to look back in history here. This action against Milosevic and the action against Assad and the action against Gaddafi and the current attempt to turn Putin into a criminal reminds me of the case of Vercingetorix, the Gallic leader who fought the Roman invaders of his territory for years and finally was packed up in a cage in which he could not stand or stretch his body and brought to Rome and allowed to be paraded around Rome in a small cage fit for a dog until the Roman people tore him apart. That is the equivalent of the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, and that is the equivalent of the international, so-called International Criminal Court. A show trial that goes far beyond anything that Stalin could have dreamed of. A show trial that goes far beyond the anti-American, un-American activities trials that McCarthy ran. This is the pinnacle of hypocrisy.
The idea is, I think, they want to throw Putin to the lions, Martin, and they actually want to do it. A trial, what you're saying here, is actually in Ukraine itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think back to the ICC trials of Yugoslav, people from Yugoslavia, there was at least some attempt to recognise that the blame was on all sides. So the Croatians also had to be indicted and so on. And what's happened in the Ukraine is very similar to the collapse of Yugoslavia, because the Eastern Russian-speaking Orthodox population do not want to be part of the Ukraine, which was only created in 1991. So they wanted to break away. And that's you know, that kind of conflict is fairly endemic all over the world. It's a normal-style conflict. And John Bolton, for example, at one stage, there was a suggestion that the International Criminal Court should look into, not indict, but look into crimes by the Israelis against the Palestinians. And John Bolton, who was a major figure in George W. Bush's administration, said that the International Criminal Court lawyers should not do this, and that the United States knew where their children lived. And that was his exact words. And these people are supposedly the paragons of justice. It's a farce, isn't it? And of course, in the Ukraine itself, the Bucha massacre, which has been made such a big deal of, that looks pretty clear that was carried out by the SBU and the Azov Battalion, probably with advice from British Special Forces people. And are those people going to stand trial? Is Brigadier Gordon Kerr going to stand trial in this country for murdering loads of people in Northern Ireland when he was running the Loyalist death squads and the IRA's internal security operation? He's obviously on a pension somewhere. The last time we heard of him, he was actually in the Green Zone in Iraq, running something called the Joint Services Group. This is quite a small country, John. It's much smaller than Canada or Russia. These people are living among us. They're living among us, and they are some of the worst war criminals on the planet.
Anyway, the final clip from Sir Geoffrey Nice, you'll be pleased to hear. Here he explains how actually the idea really is to have some sort of trial with Putin in absentia.
Around the UK, listening to you, will be people who just don't think this is going to happen, that the prospect of getting President Putin against his will anywhere is impossible. There aren't very many people who think this is going to happen.
Having him tried in person and judged as at present is, of course, improbable. But setting that improbability on one side, in order to try Putin, you don't have to have him physically present. You can try him, if you make arrangements to do so, in absentia. And providing you have a trial that is fully public, run by people of integrity, and of course there are going to be people of integrity who could run such a trial in Ukraine, or if physically being in the territory is difficult because of the risk of being bombed somewhere else, you can have a trial. And providing the trial is in every sense fair and in accordance with modern standards, then that will be a trial that will have a result, even if he's not there.
Sir Geoffrey Nice. We put those views to the office of Karim Khan, who's the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. In a statement, the ICC said Mr. Khan had gone on record repeatedly to demonstrate that accountability is an imperative that must be achieved. It said Mr. Khan had been working on the ground in Ukraine to collect evidence of war crimes, and arrest warrants would be issued when enough proof had been gathered, adding any assertion that pressure or influence may have been brought to bear on the office of the prosecutor or on the prosecutor himself to delay any investigations or applications for extraneous reasons is false. It's 9:41, it's BH on New Year's Day. Today's producers were Kat Farnsworth and Kitty Hatchley. The editor was Charlotte Hayward. From our team to yours, we wish you what we wish ourselves, a peaceful and prosperous new year.
Oh, interesting. Paddy O'Connell says that we wish ourselves a happy new year and we wish you a happy new year. It's just, I mean, interesting to put the names, I think, of the producers who decided that this was a great item. It seems to me, John, that what they're trying to do with media like this is just simply pressurise the ICC to get some sort of speedy prosecution of Putin going. I mean, I don't know if the ICC will actually take very kindly to that sort of thing. But I found it fascinating that this was the way the BBC radio on BBC Radio 4 decided to open the new year.
Well, BBC Radio is yet another arm of the entire military-industrial complex. I know this sounds repetitive, but every single quoted source from their side is just a puppet on a string. We talk about the integrity. They said I heard the quote where they said, we think there are some people of integrity in the West. Not one human being of any kind of integrity could ever participate in a trial in absentia. A trial in absentia of a man who is doing nothing other than protecting the national sovereignty of his nation. President Putin is actually using NATO's own excuse for intervention called R2P, right responsibility to protect. There is a large mass of the Ukrainian population that consider them to be themselves to be Russians. In fact, the entire Ukrainian population is Russian, but there is a group of them that insist that they are Russian and identify themselves as Russians. And under NATO's own responsibility to protect, R2P, he had every right to intervene to protect these people from the 8 years of war. Why is Geoffrey Nice not talking about indicting the people who brought this war to the current stage before Putin intervened? Why is Geoffrey Nice not talking about the fact that the War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia was not permitted to try Richard Holbrooke, to try Madeleine Albright, to try all of the people who set up and executed the war? What they're doing is turning the people who are ending up fighting to defend their countries into the villains, and they're making the master villains the heroes. These people are not going to be able to get away with it, and this is why we have war in this world today, because there is no justice.
Well, we've got something in the UK called the Stop the War Coalition, and on Saturday the 21st of January, between 10:30 a.m. and 4 p.m. at Hamilton House, Mabledon Place, London, WC1H 9BD, they're having their World at War, a trade union issue, Stop the War conference. Speakers including Jeremy Corbyn, MP, still just about an MP, apparently, Kevin Courtney, Alex Gordon from the RMT, Fran Heathcote, Lindsay German, Andrew Murray, Salma Yakubu from Stop the War. But the thing is that when they have these conferences, John, you know, this so-called Stop the War coalition, and it's nice that there is such a thing here in the UK, they don't ever invite Iranian speakers. They don't ever invite Chinese speakers. They don't ever invite Russian speakers to these. I don't know if they can ever stop the war if they don't see that to do that, you've got to have speakers from all sides of the conflict.
They don't even use modern technology to allow these speakers to speak remotely over Skype as we're doing this call now. They do not want those voices to be heard by anyone. You know, there's starting, we're talking about this period of globalization. There's starting to be a real overlap here. Example, the case that I fought to free Bobby Fischer from Japan, and we won that case, and we got Bobby to asylum in Iceland. That case was covered by two journalists from Iceland who helped me to find asylum and get the Icelandic parliament to vote 40-0 to give citizenship to Bobby Fischer. Those two reporters, one of those two is now the acting head of WikiLeaks defending Julian Assange. The man stayed in my home in Japan, in Tokyo. What's happening now is the offenses against justice, the offenses against the truth are overlapping so much that the same people who are defending innocent people like Bobby Fischer in Japan are now the same people who are defending innocent people like Julian Assange. This is becoming a single battle of good versus incalculable evil.
Interesting that Jeffrey Nice doesn't mention Assange, isn't it? I suppose that's convenient, but we're hearing a little bit about Assange in a minute. But final clip, this isn't Jeffrey Nice, Mr. Nice Guy, supposedly. This time we're going to hear from someone who died last year. He was somebody I met at the Bilderberg conference in 2016 by the name of Manfred Petrich, and he actually was the son of a Nazi a jet engine designer who was born over in Argentina after the Second World War, and then got, when he left school, got a job straight into one of the big finance houses in Switzerland, and spent quite a long time working there until 2001, when some of his friends were killed in the World Trade Center disaster, and he realized, look, this is actually a false flag attack on the World Trade Center, and so he left Switzerland in disgust, settled in Abkhazia, and died there last year. But he had a very, I think, interesting insight. He believed that much of what we're seeing today in the West is just a continuation of Nazi Germany. So let's hear a little clip from Manfred Petrich now. Why have you gone from this kind of safe haven in Switzerland to somewhere which is potentially a bit of a hot potato?
Well, I'm sorry, I have to completely destroy your illusions. First of all, Switzerland is not a safe haven. Secondly, our politicians in Switzerland are exactly the same traitors as like in all the EU countries. They would sell Switzerland to Brussels in 5 minutes if they could. And that's why our head of parliament, the president of the Swiss parliament, was in Dresden at the Bilderberg meeting. I also talked to her for 2 hours after the meeting. That means... you see, for me, when the Bilderberg meeting in 2011 was in Switzerland, I realized by watching what was happening and organizing the protests there that we have lost the game. We have lost the game. And that the politicians have nothing to say. They have nothing to say. They're all controlled by the big, huge corporations. And we have the problem that they have all the power. They own the military, they own the media, they own the police, they own the judges, they own the all the powers that you need. And we on the other side, we own nothing. So we have lost. And also that there is this absolutely hysterical drive to make war with Russia. I mean, we see this in the last years, how they have been bashing Russia and Putin like hell. And they also moved all their troops and their weapons towards the Russian border. They have now installed this so-called anti-ballistic rocket system in Romania, which they're telling us are against rockets of Iran and North Korea, which is a laugh. Now, you said before that I moved into an area which could be a potential target. No. The potential target is Europe. Europe will be flattened in a future war. Not Russia or America. Europe will be flattened again. And I tell this to all my German friends. I tell them, do you realize that because of all the American military bases there, all the command centers in Germany, AFRICOM, CENTCOM, and all these bases, and also that you have atomic weapons stored in Germany, that you are a prime target for a war? That the first thing that will be hit is Germany? Because that's where all the Americans have their bases. And all wars come from German territory.
Well, hang on a minute, because you've just talked about CENTCOM and AFRICOM. What are they and where are they based? We don't hear about them in the news.
Well, that doesn't mean they don't exist. I mean, CENTCOM and AFRICOM, for instance, the center is in Stuttgart. That's the command center for all the military operations which are done in Africa and in the Middle East. It's all controlled from Stuttgart, the big military base there and command center there. The same applies to, for instance, Rammstein. From Rammstein, all the killer drones are controlled, which fly over Pakistan and Yemen and Afghanistan and North Africa, wherever they fly around and kill people. They're all controlled from Rammstein, this huge Air Force base there. And Wiesbaden is the big European military center command. You see, there are over 70,000 American troops based in Germany. 70,000 American soldiers occupying Germany. That's the most occupying force in the whole of the world. Well, more than in Japan or more than in South Korea.
So that's the voice of Manfred Petrich, passed away last year. His blog in German was always worth a read, called All Smoke and Mirrors, or Alles Schall und Rausch. What do you make of what he was saying there, John, particularly about this whole kind of US attitude to Russia?
Well, once again, I'm sorry to go back to the same theme, but we have a situation here where everything we're told is a lie. Switzerland is no neutral country. Sweden was not a neutral country. Finland was not a neutral country. The big move by Sweden and Finland to join NATO is just an admission of the truth that they were NATO tag-alongs. Switzerland, I'm in contact with Oskar Freisinger, who was the vice president of the ruling party in Switzerland. He came over here to Serbia to speak in the defense of the Serbs against NATO. And this is a man who was in the Swiss system and denounced the Swiss system. We've got an author, a non-combatant author from Serbia, who went by the pen name Alexander Dorin, who wrote a book negating the false story about genocide at Srebrenica. That man is wanted in Switzerland. The Swiss tried to hold him in jail. They put him in jail without a lawyer, without access to a lawyer, without notifying anybody that he had even been arrested. They held him for 4.5 months before I found out about it and went to the Swiss embassy here in Belgrade to assist upon his release. We got him released, and he's now here in Serbia, fleeing from the NATO-run lie machine that has taken over Switzerland. This is a global war. It has already started, just like World War II had already started when England and America started financing Adolf Hitler, expecting him to attack the Soviet Union and not them. These people will never stop. We need to change the way the world is run. It is a battle that has no equivalent in modern history.
No, it certainly doesn't. One person who was puncturing those lies time after time after time and is now languishing in this dungeon, King Charles's dungeon at Belmarsh Prison, is Julian Assange, one of his biggest supporters, who was the punk dress designer and clothes designer, Vivienne Westwood, had this to say before she died about Julian.
I've been fighting for Julian for 10 years. I'm a freedom fighter. I'm an activist. 7 billion people don't know what the f*** is going on in this world. He throws a light on the whole corruption, and he's a Democrat, and we don't have democracy. And it's terribly, terribly important to save him because he's a symbol. And if he goes, we've got Armageddon, because the world is in turmoil and nobody knows the truth, because the newspapers don't report the truth. Everybody's ignorant.
That's Vivienne Westwood, bless her. In fact, I didn't know that anarchists, Martin, were also into democracy. Apparently, Vivienne Westwood was, and she was saying that he's very important. But also, Martin, it's interesting she's using the word Armageddon there, the Armageddonists. Without people like Assange, without a free press, criticising the lies of our governments, of our military, etc., really, we are staring into that sort of, well, into the barrel of a gun, really, aren't we? We're saying, well, actually, this is it, civilization is over.
Well, apart from the fact that the Russian special military operation in the Ukraine has punctured NATO's vision of invulnerability, and of you know, the struggle is on, but it's in the past. We would, you know, people like us, you know, calling out 9/11 or whatever. I'm quite sure that the Russian general staff know very well what happened on 9/11. And that was always going to be a game changer, but not in the way the people who did it think. Ultimately, it looks to me, I'm not an expert on it, but it looks to me as if the Russian military have got the measure of NATO, and it's NATO who are going to lose here.
It's interesting Vivienne Westwood is seeing Armageddon as something terrible and bleak, John. But as you know, Armageddon is a battle between good and evil, where good actually wins. So, I mean, she's predicting Armageddon from what's going on with Julian Assange, and obviously now I'm sure she would talk about similar context with Ukraine. Where do you think this is all going?
Well, my prediction is that it will not be long before the broad mass of humanity realizes that it is the leadership that is misleading us. It is a self-perpetuating leadership that creates new candidates to replace the old ones, and that those leaders themselves are going to be targeted by radical opponents of this world order. And I think we're going to see a system similar to what happened during the Crusades, when kings and princes came from Europe to seize the Holy Land and they were stopped by assassins. I think we're going to see a period in which world leaders all over the place are going to be killed one after the other. Not like John F. Kennedy, one man, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, one per month, until they're all dead. And then people will realize that the head of the snake was just the tiny, tiny self-perpetuating elite that sold themselves to all of us through their lying media and who demonized anybody who defended their national sovereignty. I think that's what's going to happen. I regret to say that a lot of people are going to die, and there are going to be a lot of assassinations. Because if we have to choose between Armageddon, in which hundreds of millions are killed, and a series of assassinations in which just hundreds of people are going to be killed, then I would suggest that probability tells us that the assassinations will take place first. Because the human race wants to survive. As a living creature, it wants to survive. And if death is the only alternative for all of us being offered by these self-perpetuating, anti-democratic, lying elites, then those elites are going to fall. That's what's going to happen.
All right, John. Do you want to just wind up by plugging how people can follow you online, if we're still allowed to? I'm not sure if there's some sort of firewall around Belgrade these days.
No, the best way to follow me, I know it's old-fashioned, but I post on Facebook under my own name, and I post everything I'm doing there. I'm on television here in Serbia at least once or twice a week. Those interviews are in Serbian, which I learned over the years since I moved here. But I do post in English, and I post a lot of interesting articles and links to other people's activities. Similarly, I appear in English on Iranian Press TV, and I appear on various other media around the world. So the best place to look is go first to Facebook. I'm still there, and I'm very careful about what I say there because the censors are looking at me. I've been banned many times, but Facebook is the place to go. And this year, 2023, I'll be producing my own podcast, and you can find the link to that soon in Facebook.
Okay, well, you're luckier than I am. Facebook seems to find any excuse, nothing, in fact, to... I'm in Facebook jail till the end of January, John, so well done for managing to stay up on there. And, of course, as everyone should know, VK.com is a kind of alternative Russian version of Facebook, which is a good way to follow also Russian media. Anyway, thanks ever so much for bearing with us for an hour and a half, John. You've done a fantastic job there.
My pleasure.
It's time to sign off now. Thanks to our guests, Irish Republican, Labour activist Martin Summers, also, as you heard there, from Belgrade, John Bosnich, and also, of course, sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page or on my WhatsApp, etc. You can find all the details you need to do with this programme, including comments, etc., and the long interviews at the end, which I usually upload on the Friday evening, quite late sometimes, at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I've got paperbacks you can get too. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at talkradio.org.uk and the app at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down.
Some morning to the sound of something moving past your window in the wind, and if you're quick enough to rise, you'll catch the fleeting glimpse of someone's fading shadow out on the new horizon. You may see the floating motion of a distant pair of wings, and if the sleep has left your ears, you might hear footsteps running through an open meadow. Don't be concerned, it will not harm you. It's only me pursuing something I'm not sure of. Across my dreams, with nets of wonder, I chase the bright, elusive butterfly of love. You might have heard my footsteps echo softly in the distance through the canyons of your mind. I might have even called your name as I ran searching after something to believe in. You might have seen me running through the long abandoned ruins of the dreams you left behind. If you remember something there that glided past you, followed close by heavy breathing, don't be concerned, it will not harm you. It's only me pursuing something I'm not sure of. Across my dreams, with nets of wonder, I chase the bright, elusive butterfly of love.
in wonder. I chase the bright and sieve butterfly.